African-Americans had one full citizenship in the civil rights movement. And I didn't know much about that. It's actually quite different from that. We had, you know, after the Civil War, sharecropping, but African-Americans had full citizenship in North Carolina for a time, and won election to public office. This sputtered, didn't go very well, but in the 1890s, we had a period, something like the period that we're in right now, where you had the collapse of the economy. I mean, everybody was a farmer in the 1890s, and statistically, you know, high 90% of people worked in agriculture. And there was an agricultural depression that lasted for a decade or so. Anyway, this gave rise to movements among white farmers who were trying to organize against the railroads and the banks and get a better deal for themselves and a better life for their families. And they turned to their African-American fellow citizens who had their own concerns and formed what was called the Fusion Movement, a fusion between people who had left the Democratic Party, which was the party of white supremacy, as it called itself at the time, or the conservatives, they also called themselves, and joined. So we had an interracial coalition in North Carolina that won the governor's race in 1896. It won both United States Senate seats. It won every statewide election. It took the whole legislature, and could not be beaten at the polls. But this was very much unacceptable to the rising industrial class and to the banks and to the railroads and to white people whose sense of how things were supposed to be was offended by black citizenship. And what was organized was the White Supremacy Campaign of 1898, around the election of 1898, the governor's election. Charles B. Aycock, who you may have heard of, and Furnival, who became governor of North Carolina, Furnival Simmons, who became senator from North Carolina for the next six terms, and Josephus Daniels, who was the publisher of the News and Observer, and one of the leading Democrats in the country. They organized this white supremacy campaign and plotted, basically they overthrew the government of North Carolina. The culmination of by fraud, electoral fraud, by force, intimidation, terrorism, murder, and also by using a kind of racial demagoguery, especially using sexualized language about black men. So it culminates with the Wilmington Race Riot. Wilmington's the biggest city in the state in 1898. It's got a slight black majority, and it's the stronghold of this Fusion Coalition. The Fusion Coalition was, you know, white and black, mostly run by white people. It wasn't the Garden of Eden and perfect or anything. The children of former slaves and slave owners had gotten together in this interracial coalition. The Wilmington Race Riot was a kind of massacre and coup. They made the whole city government of Wilmington resign at gunpoint. White people and black people, they killed some unknown number of people. We really don't know whether it was probably 80 or 90 is a good bet, but dozens, perhaps hundreds of people. They marched other people to the train station and made them leave North Carolina and declared themselves the government of Wilmington. So we got, as soon as Governor Aycock took power in North Carolina in 1898, the first order of business was taking the vote away from blacks. Because if the whites who had been in this coalition, if blacks couldn't vote, then the whites who had been in the coalition basically would have nowhere to go politically. And what got put in place was a one-party state, with the Democratic Party being the government, the party of the white man. Jonathan Daniels called it permanent good government by the party of the white man. So this, and that is pretty much what put the That's when the segregation laws were put in place. That's when you get separation of races in all areas of public life. That stuff comes in the wake of this. And this is the next six governors of North Carolina all participated in the white supremacy campaign of 1898. It was the political credential you had to have for a white Democrat until the 1960s, really, when this set of arrangements gets broken up by the civil rights movement. I wanted to focus just for a second on the most important, what I think is the most important episode in the whole civil rights movement, which came out of North Carolina. Now if you know about the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, and the rise of with Rosa Parks and the rise of Martin Luther King, but 1955. The sit-ins don't happen until 1960, and in between 1955 and 1960, you get five long years where not too much is accomplished in terms of civil rights. There's a huge movement against civil rights called the White Citizens Council movement, and that's what otherwise is a wave of terrorism across the South. There's a wave of intimidation, and not much. If you look between 1955 and 1960, there's not much that you can put on the accomplishment chart for the civil rights movement. But on February 1st, 1960, in Greensboro, four students at North Carolina A&T, young black college students, they were members of the NAACP Youth Council, and they go in and sit, they go to Woolworths, and the way Woolworths was set up, and the way all the drugstores were set up, is they had a lunch counter where white people could sit and get lunch and stuff. Anybody could, with money, could go in and buy shampoo and toothpaste, you know, but you could, the lunch counter was quite something. So what they did was went in and bought some soap and toothpaste and the things to establish that they were customers, and then went and sat in the whites-only section and refused to move or to try to order lunch. They did that on Monday. On Tuesday, they came back with 25 people and filled in all the seats. On Wednesday, they came back with 63 or 64 people and took shifts. On Thursday, there were hundreds, and some white students actually joined them on Thursday. One of my favorite scenes in the whole civil rights movement happens on Thursday, because these thugs come out, these white hoodlums come out to stop them from sitting at the lunch counter, and they get in front of the door of Woolworths and won't let anybody in, and they're sort of pushing people and shoving and menacing people. And so what they did was went and got the North Carolina A&T football team, and just the football team forms this kind of flying wedge and just goes trotting through the hoodlums like it's a kickoff, boom, right up to the door, and they form a funnel made out of football team, and then everybody goes in through that way. And one of the hoodlums says, "Who the hell do you people think you are?" And one of the football players said, "We're the Union Army." But at any rate, within a couple of weeks, this had spread to Durham and Raleigh and Charlotte. Within a few months, it spread to 54 cities across 9 states. Within a couple of years, hundreds of cities. It's really what made the civil rights movement happen, in a sense. This is new, aggressive, student-led phase of the civil rights movement that gave it such impetus and broke the stalemate that it was in. But I really think it's the most important moment in the movement. It inspired the creation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Raleigh in 1960. People came from across the South, young people. No older than yourselves, really. And one thing I just wanted to mention was the sit-in movement is this incredibly bold and creative thing, and none of the grown-ups are in favor of this. Not even Martin Luther King is in favor of the sit-in movement at first. The NAACP was against it. It was really the young people's thing. And they did it with a lot of style. They would wear their Sunday best, people would wear ties and dresses and gloves and act like they were going to church or a little overdressed for school, but carry your school books and just go in and sit down and do their work. And it became very politically difficult, you know, to, and people got cigarettes put out on and ketchup dumped on their head, and got, people got beat up. It got rough at times, but it was very politically difficult to put their opponents in a difficult spot because of the kind of dignity and respectability that they took with them. Anyway, they end up founding at Shaw University over in the spring of 1960 the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is probably the most influential organization in the civil rights movement. So an important moment here in North Carolina, and one I think has a lot of lessons for us today. Yanni knows a good deal about, Yanni's written a brilliant dissertation on the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill.
Thesis.
What's it?
Thesis is on the civil rights movement. The dissertation is on black freedom in the university.
Oh, okay. Sorry. My bad. But anyway, he knows more than anybody else about the movement in Chapel Hill.
Well, I'm going to take a different approach than Tim has. He's really given you a very compressed, sort of clear picture of some of the developments that led to the civil rights movement and the 1898 white supremacy campaign that established what we call Jim Crow. But I'm not going to try to give you as a coherent history of things. I've got pictures to show you, and I've got questions to ask, and I know that, I don't know if Michelle Laws is going to come. She's the first vice president of the Chapel Hill NAACP, and a good friend. And if she gets here, she can talk with you about some of the struggles that are going on today. And I don't know why you all are here, but the reason I'm here is not only because you all invited me, but because for the last as many years as I can remember, I've devoted my life to the struggle for racial justice, and most of that time been here in Chapel Hill. I started off when I was your age, and when I was in high school, the civil rights movement, SNCC, and all of that that Tim was talking about was starting up in the South. I knew very little about it, but I wanted to do some kind of civil rights work, and my mother said, no way. So she sent me off to an Indian reservation in South Dakota, which was the end of me being a normal kid, and I became totally outraged and angry and radical because the situation for Indians in this country has just been incredibly horrendous. And I learned that history, and I got to know people firsthand, so that's how I got started. But the thing I would like to ask y'all is why are, you know, oh, I know. I was going to say, you know, sort of from that moment on, I decided that I was really interested in history, and I decided that we don't know this history. I never knew anything about what happened to the Indians or what they did to fight back. I didn't know anything about Jim Crow or any kind of segregation or anything. I grew up in Ohio. I didn't even know any black people. The only black people I saw were maids and yard men who came to take care of the rich people's lawns in the neighborhood I lived in. But we didn't have any black kids in our school. I had not a clue until I get out in the world, and then there was this movement, and I started getting interested in that for some peculiar reason. Only a few of the other people in my high school class, 1965. Really got involved the way I did, and why it was me and a few others, I'm not sure, but that's the way it works. Some people get very involved and a lot of people don't. But I always had that idea that if people could understand history and how things got to be the way they are, then that would give you a kind of tool that you needed to try to fix things and make things better. You know, like if you don't know how I would use the analogy of a car engine. If you don't know how a car engine works, you can't very well fix it and come up, let alone come up with a better car engine. Probably that's not the most appropriate thing. You know, we say like now, if you don't understand how software works, you know, you can't really come up with the right tool to use. And so I always saw history as a tool. And that's when I came here to Chapel Hill, I did grassroots organizing because I had come to the South to do organizing, actually. And eventually I came to the point where I decided to go to graduate school and retrieve the history of African Americans in Chapel Hill. And I started with the Civil Rights Movement. And I've kept with that because I think that there's a lot of problems today. Some of them I'm sure you're aware of, the so-called minority achievement gap in the public schools. The you know, issue of low wages for workers of color, the issue of police harassment in the black community, you know, all kinds of issues like that. And like Obama said, you know, we're not yet the promise that we promised to be, you know, in America. We have a dream, but we're not really there yet. And we have to face our past, honestly. Like the stuff that Tim was talking about from 1898, for 100 years, that was totally denied in North Carolina. People in Wilmington either wouldn't talk about it or said it didn't happen that way. Just like slave owners said, slaves were happy and there was no problem with slavery. And in Chapel Hill, which had a reputation in 1960 as the southern part of heaven, people were shocked when there was a civil rights movement in Chapel Hill. So that's a little bit about why I'm here. I want to solve the problems of today. And I think history is a good tool. I'm curious about why y'all are here. And I won't answer this. I'm going to turn this off. Too bad I had to hang up on it with my doctor. And, you know, I don't really understand why you're all here. I know it's Spring Fest. And I understand that there were different topics, and my thinking was that you all signed up voluntarily for certain topics, but actually getting vibes from a few of you before the class started, I wasn't actually sure that you had a choice whether to be here or not. But I wonder if any of you would just be willing to tell me, you know, why you're here or what you hope to get out of it. Or if you, I don't really care if you say I don't really want to be here, I don't have anything else to do. But, you know, whatever. Somebody be the first one to speak up, because that's how the Civil Rights Movement started, for A&T students deciding to speak up. A little bit louder, I
hear. Only the seniors get what they want. Everyone else just has like assigned their classes.
And you're not a senior. So you got assigned, but the seniors got choice?
Well, we get priority.
Well, we get a choice, we don't get as much of a choice. I actually didn't get any choice at all, because at the end of the day we signed up, but I like history, so.
Are you a senior?
No, I'm a freshman.
Uh-huh. Do you have any seniors? This was your choice?
I don't remember what it is.
Is anybody here because I really wanted to find out about civil rights and black freedom in North Carolina? Deep concern for anybody?
I like history.
I thought it was for pastry making.
Pastry making, that's what you signed up for. Let's see, it's like pastry making.
Pastry making.
well, you're going to come out with a crummy cake if you don't know, you know, what goes into cake making. You're going to come out with a crummy result in your society if you don't know what goes into making a better society. Anybody else have a reason for being here, or seemed like the thing about not getting a choice sort of stirred up a little stuff? So most of you were assigned. Anybody who wasn't assigned, anybody who actually asked to be here? Okay, but that's good to know. Well, we'll try to make it interesting for you. So, was chapel, I got to ask questions, because I want you guys to talk, even if you don't really care. Or did you pick this thing on purpose? And I'm making a big sacrifice to get here, because I'm really sick and I can't move about real easy, so I'm going to get tricky with that. You make my time worth it, and I'll try to entertain you. Was Chapel Hill a society where there was slavery before 1865 or not? Anybody know for sure? Yes, slaves? How many think? No slaves?
North Carolina has slaves, but I don't know if Chapel Hill is.
Okay. That's probably about right. I mean, I think that a lot of people today don't understand that North Carolina was a slave state, and maybe don't know particularly that Chapel Hill, it was actually, this was the headquarters of slavery in Orange County. We had a higher percentage of slave owners here than anywhere else in the county. And let's see. Let's see if I get this right. Okay, this is from a newspaper ad back, see, at Chapel Hill, Andrew Nichol, Chapel Hill, slaves, valuable slaves for sale. Slaves were the most valuable type of property in the South, way more than land. And they were also prestige, that's where your profits came from. Okay, Chapel Hill. There's something called the manuscript census that if any of you like history, you want to look at someday. And it's on microfilm, or you know, you can get it in a lot of, you can find it online with these genealogy programs like Ancestry.com. This is what the manuscript census looks like. This is for 1850. And this is how, this is a special schedule, as they call them, that enumerated the slaves of the slave owner. The name of the slave does not appear. Those names that you see on the left side are the name of the slave owner. And the slaves are simply enumerated with this slash. That's a slave. 50 years old. Male. Black. Here's a little bit of a difference. 57 years old, male, mulatto. Okay, they describe slaves as either black or mulatto. Anybody know what mulatto means?
It means they have some white ancestry.
Talk a little louder. I gotta be.
It means they have some white ancestry.
Yeah, is that what you were gonna say? Yeah, right. And how did a black slave from Africa get white ancestors? Four-letter word beginning with R.
Really?
Right. Slavery was not nice, no matter who practiced it. By the way, that William Horn Battle, who was up there, his guy started the law school at UNC. He trained all the judges in North Carolina and lawyers. Let's see. I'm not going to go through that. That's another part of the manuscript census. It just shows you in 1800 how many were slaves and how many were free. It was basically about half the population were slaves and half were free white people. and what all that slavery led to, and 1898, you know, the defeat of this biracial fusion stuff, it led to a situation that we call Jim Crow. Anybody heard that term, Jim Crow? Anybody else? You guys over there? Yeah. So what was Jim Crow? A bunch of laws that separated the blacks from the whites. That's a pretty good definition. It was a little bit more than that, because they weren't always laws. Sometimes they were just customs. And it also included terror, so that if you didn't stay separated, in other words, if a black person didn't stay in their place, you could get lynched, right? But mostly what it meant was that Jim Crow forced almost all black people in Chapel Hill, and really throughout the South, if they didn't live on farms, to be part of a demeaned, racially defined laboring caste system. And so in Chapel Hill, this is what it looked like. That's a professor there, and that's his maid. Young white, young black woman, probably teenager, and serving his food. And that's how white people grew up in Chapel Hill, and that's how black people grew up. So Jim Crow in Chapel Hill was just as bad as it was anyplace else, but it had a little bit of a sugar coating to it. Chapel Hill was a little bit liberal compared to Birmingham, Alabama, let's say. But the schools were all segregated, the black schools were not equal, the jobs were all segregated, black people couldn't get skilled jobs, had to be a laborer or a maid or a cook. The housing was all segregated. In other words, everything was done to convince black people and white people that black people were really less than human. And that's an ideology of white supremacy. And that we are still dealing with today. Civil rights movement helped, but it really didn't get far beneath the legal problems of segregation. And in my opinion, the persistence of those kind of ideas from Jim Crow is what is behind a lot of the social problems that we have, including the minority achievement gap. Let me just show you. Okay, so we had this big civil rights movement in Chapel Hill because of these kinds of conditions, and like I said, it shocked a lot of people. How long do we have? Until
10 to 5.
Until 10 to 5. Okay. So let's see. These are some of the people who were marching down Franklin Street. Like Tim said, in 1960 there was a sit-in movement in Greensboro. Now in Chapel Hill, all of these sit-in movements that popped up immediately after Greensboro were in North Carolina communities and eventually up into Virginia and other places where there were black colleges and universities. And the people who generally led these things, not always, but in almost all cases, were university students. Okay, like you said, the elders weren't really into this thing. They wanted to do lawsuits or nothing, you know. And this was a big generational problem because the young people didn't respect, you know, that kind of approach to dealing with the indignities that they face. So they were basically rebels. But it's not as though in Chapel Hill, so the movement started at the end of February instead of at the beginning of February. And who led the Chapel Hill civil rights movement since there was no black college or university in Chapel Hill? Anybody know who led the local Chapel Hill civil rights movement? High school students. That's you. High school students. High school students from where?
The Lincoln Center.
Well, Lincoln Center is what it was called after the black high school was shut down. It was Lincoln High School. That was the black high school in Chapel Hill and for a good chunk of Orange County. And Lincoln High School was the pride of the black community. They had a state championship football team. They had a state championship marching band. And that's saying a lot because they were a little teeny-weeny school. This is not a very big community. So there was a group of young guys who were friends. James Britton, Harold Foster, etc., etc., Thomas Mason. And they started the civil rights movement. They did the first sit-in on February 28th. They tried to get their other classmates in school to do it with them. Nobody would do it. So just like I said, somebody's got to take the first step. You don't take it yourself, nobody else can take it. So you speak up, you stand up. And so they went and sat in and got arrested at a Colonial Drug Store. And the next day, half of Lincoln High School was out there picketing. So that's how the whole thing got started. And that went on.
How many went the first day?
It was about 6, 7, 8. I like that. The numbers are a little bit hard to come by. People have different memories of exactly who was there. But they were all guys, and the only reason why they were all guys, partly it was just, you know, the tenor of the times. There hadn't been a women's movement or anything like that. But partly it was because they were all sort of rebellious buddies who hung out together, and they had experience sort of going against the norms of not only white society, but also a black society. They went where they weren't supposed to go. They read what they weren't supposed to read. Thomas Mason and James Britton got kicked out of high school or suspended for 2 weeks because they said in class that maybe there was something good to the Cuban Revolution in 1958. You know, because if the U.S. government was against the Cuban Revolution and they were against black people, then maybe there was something good to it. You know, they kicked them out of school for 2 weeks. So these folks were rebellious. But there was older people and there was white people involved too. And this shows you one of the much older women. And they, what was an Uncle Tom? It says, no more Uncle Tom. What's an Uncle Tom?
He was a character in the book Uncle Tom's Cabin. He was just kind of known for just pandering to white people.
Pandering to white people, yeah. That's what a lot of people thought some of the black leaders were doing in Chapel Hill. You know, they wouldn't step out and challenge Jim Crow. But you have to realize that they had a lot to lose. You know, they were responsible for schools, and they were the ones who all worked at the university. And the university was not sympathetic to civil rights. So if you stepped out and marched or did something like that in Chapel Hill, you worked as a laundry worker at the university, you might lose your job because your supervisor was definitely going to be white and was most likely a segregationist. So it turns out that the Chapel Hill civil rights movement was very big. What?
I just said, whoa, it's so, I'm just, the size of it.
Yeah. that's not the biggest march either. That's not the first march. The first march was about 500. and this is before the Chapel Hill Weekly stopped covering the civil rights movement. They got fed up with it, and they stopped. They just had little blips here and there, but, you know, sort of. What's new on question A, they called it. So this was, the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill went by stages. And, you know, the sit-in movement actually sort of failed in a certain sense in 1960. They did desegregate a couple of places, but not very much. And then it sort of slowed down, and it was sort of taken over by more cautious people, including some white liberals, and they picketed the movie theaters for a year or two. And that actually ended up successful. Those movie theaters were forced to desegregate, because actually there was a lot of students at the university who supported desegregation. And so they boycotted the movies, and the movies lost money, and so they desegregated. But most of Chapel Hill was not desegregated by 1963 when this article came out. And so a new coalition formed that was, the core of it was black high school students from Lincoln and radical white college students from UNC. And so they started doing these marches and sit-ins, and you know, even at the black high school there was a walkout because the principal was limiting their ability to participate in the movement. So you can see this is a full-scale revolt. And I want to just impress on you that this was led by very young people. That is Mary Mason. She was the first chairperson of the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill. And that's a picture of her when she was in high school. You know, your age. So this means that you are the hope, and you all can change the world. Don't ever think that because you're young, you can't.
Now, what was the date of that, the sit-ins
started? The sit-in started on February 28th, 1960 in Chapel Hill.
Okay. So now, is she still alive?
Yeah. Mary Mason is still alive, yes. She lives in Virginia, and her father was what they called a houseboy at one of the fraternities, which was frankly one of the better jobs that black people could get. Sort of demeaning, but all of his kids participated in the civil rights movement. And I won't tell you stories. I've interviewed him before he died. But his daughter Mary was admitted to UNC in the early 1960s. She would have been the first black woman to attend UNC. But the family could not afford to send her there, so she went to North Carolina Central. Right? Both of her sons graduated from UNC. I'm not quite sure where they are now, but you know, she lives in Virginia. And that wouldn't have happened without the civil rights movement. This is a sit-in outside of Colonial Drugstore, maybe, or some place. And you can see the police there. They arrested people. And you can see that there's a mix of people. Most of them are black, but there's a number of white people in there, too, and they're college students. There were a few black college students at UNC by that time, but not very many. Let's see, what else we got here? This is some close-up pictures of one of the big civil rights marches. You can see quite a mix of people here, but you really see young people taking the lead here. This is a white college professor here. I think that's Al M. I'm not sure. But there were a number of white professors who joined, got arrested. At Duke also, they joined. People from Durham came over. I try to go through this a little bit more quick. There were a lot of real young people who participated. They usually come with a brother and sister. Now these two kids here are alive and live nearby. We tried to get them at our most recent event, and actually I was so busy organizing it, I don't know if they were there or not, but they were contacted. And handheld signs, homemade, little kids who were into it, just like old people, led by students. Now you have to understand that high school students had a little bit different kind of a class background than black college students. Black college students were definitely upwardly mobile. A lot of them had nobody else in their family ever gone to college, but at least they were in college, and maybe their families were professionals and stuff. High school students in Chapel Hill, almost every single one of them, their father was a menial laborer, their mother was a maid, a cook, something like that. So our movement was what the students themselves called very proletarian. It had a very sharp edge to it because people were really working class and oppressed. And that made it a little bit different. Whenever high school students were involved, even in Greensboro, that it took on that edge. And they were younger and they were a little wilder. Okay, this is a big march. This is the first march in Chapel Hill, I believe. Now, Tim told you the story about the flying wedge of A&T football players. That guy right there, he was part of the flying wedge. He grew up in Chapel Hill. His name is Fred Battle. He's still alive. He went on to be the head of the NAACP, my close friend for 30 years. And he was in the same class as Jesse Jackson, who was also actually made his reputation in that movement. And Fred can tell you the story of the football players and the flying wedge.
I've been eating breakfast with Fred lately, and I didn't even know that. I have to get him to tell me.
Get him to tell you. This is how they pile up the demonstrators in a pile on the road, and then they put them in the wagons. And you see, there's a bunch of angry white guys over there in the background, and the cops actually protected the demonstrators from them. But it's not like Chapel Hill wasn't a racist place. It definitely was. Anybody want to ask a question at this point?
So what brought you here from Ohio?
To organize in the South. I was part of the 60s generation. And the South was, from our points of view, maybe the most difficult place to organize, where there was the most entrenched segregationist stuff. And people thought, I thought, if we can crack the South, we can crack anything. So I came here to organize. I had grandiose ideas, you know. I thought I was going to organize the South. No way, it didn't work that way. The South organized me. This guy, James Fushi, who's still alive, and this is a picture of him being held by another one of the civil rights demonstrators after one of the segregationist store owners poured ammonia down his throat and all over his face. Ammonia is that really nasty stuff you use to clean glass with and clean floors. It's
a cleaning product. It's they use ammonia to make a throw up in the old days, didn't they?
I don't know about that, Jim.
Yeah, I think that was anyway.
But
noxious
stuff. But he had second or third degree burns from this stuff. Chapel Hill Civil Rights Movement was less violent in Mississippi. People didn't die, but it was pretty bad. These are Big John Caldwell and one of his sons. It's not a real clear picture, but this guy they're throwing out here, you can't see his face, he was 15. He was one of the very few people who started the sit-in movement in Chapel Hill. His name was James Britt, and he died, you know, when he was 50 years old, of a heart attack. But he also had become the head of the civil rights movement. Now, one thing you should understand about the movement in Chapel Hill, It started in the west part of Franklin Street. The drugstore, Colonial Drugstore, Long Meadow Dairy, places like that were the segregated white businesses in the black part of town. All of West Franklin Street was black. Down there where the wine bar is now, that was all black owned property. Okay? And so the targets were very specific segregationists to begin with. But as the movement moved along, people decided that the individual segregationists weren't the real problem. You know, the big problem was the merchants, for instance. Let me see, I should put this one up first. So the first sit-in since 1960 from the Civil Rights Movement was in the Merchants Association, which is more in the middle of town. And you can see, again, it's mostly black high school students, white college student there in the background. And there was about a whole bunch of people arrested. So they targeted the Merchants Association. It gives a sense that the understanding of the movement was developing, and they realized that it was the business owners in Chapel Hill who were demanding that everybody stay segregationist, you know, and that no single business owner cave in. Now, even that didn't work. Chapel Hill stayed pretty much segregated. And by 1963, Chapel Hill became a huge movement, focused on by the governor of the state as a big problem area. He said there never should have been a movement there. Chapel Hill was the last place anything like this should have happened. Sanford was a liberal governor. I'm going to stop in just a second. The Congress of Racial Equality, which had been sort of leading the organization in Chapel Hill, and the national leader, Jim Farmer, of the Congress of Racial Equality, came in and said, we're going to make the desegregation of Chapel Hill the focus of our work in the South. And on February 1st, that's D-Day, Chapel Hill is going to be desegregated, or we're going to cause havoc. And this was February 1st. And what they did was, they had hundreds and hundreds of civil rights demonstrators who actually set in and blocked traffic along all the major roadways of Chapel Hill. And this is the parking lot by the university. And this is after a, what would be, I guess, a basketball game against Wake Forest or something. You see, there's people trying to get out in their cars. And here's the people sitting in to block them. This guy right here, pretty sure that's Harold Foster. He was the main leader of the Chapel Hill movement. And so from, you know, just looking at individual segregationists, they learned that the business community was the real opposition. And they finally decided that they had to put pressure on the entire community, including the university, which had tried to stay out of it, which meant that they basically endorsed the status quo of segregated Chapel Hill. And so they sent a message. This was a community problem. This was not just, you know, a few redneck store owners or something. This was the university. This was the community. And that's what this was about. But this, unfortunately, was also just about the end of the movement, because there were massive arrests. And then soon, you can imagine that a lot of the liberals who had supported the Chapel Hill movement, the professors and so forth, they sort of dropped away. This was a little bit too much for them. An incredibly racist judge in North Carolina sentenced about a dozen of the main leaders of the Chapel Hill to like a year in jail or 5 years probation. You know, he said some ridiculous things to him that you would just not believe how ignorant they were. And that was sort of the end of the movement, and they never did desegregate Chapel Hill completely. But that was in 1964. But what happened, that was that there was many movements that didn't succeed. North Carolina had 55, at least 55 small movements, you know, in different, big or small. And they didn't all win by any means, but the national pressure was so great that in 1964 and 65, Jim Crow collapsed, and we had the Voting Rights Act and the Public Accommodations Act and all of that stuff. So one way or another, it was this kind of struggle that high school students led that led to the downfall of Jim Crow all across the country. And I probably should stop. There's just a few minutes left. But that gives you a little taste for a history that, frankly, you should have been taught in school, but I'm sure you weren't. And there's a reason for that, because that whole history of slavery and Jim Crow Chapel Hill is not something that powers that we want to talk about. The school system was totally racist and segregated. And the struggles of black people is what has made us a more democratic and inclusive society. And women, and all the groups that were sort of left out. So you should actually demand that the schools incorporate this kind of stuff into your curriculum. And probably hadn't heard much about 1898 either. But this is our local history. You can't understand anything about Chapel Hill if you don't understand the local history. That's it for now.
How much of the surrounding lands of Orange County were used as
plantations? Chapel Hill and Orange County weren't as big of a plantation.
Okay, that marks the end of the first session. We now have a 10-minute passing time. A 10-minute passing time, and the second session is going to start at 10:15. I'm going to ring the bell to dismiss this session, and then I'll ring the bell again to start the next session. Thanks.
There was about 30% of the heads of households in Orange County owned slaves. Most of them only owned one or two slaves. But there were some very big plantations, including the Cameron Plantation, you know, Cameron Avenue on Chapel Hill, Cameron Indoor Stadium at Duke. All those things are named after the Cameron family. And Cameron was the biggest slave owner in North Carolina. He had about 1,000 slaves and several plantations. The biggest slaveholding area was out there by Wilmington and the eastern part of the state. It's called the Tidewater. And the big, flat, fertile land, that was really good for agricultural farming. We had a lot of small farmers here. When the vote was taken in 18, you know, for the disfranchisement thing, it lost in Orange County.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It was close, but
I live
lost.
Less than a mile from Franklin Street, and the hillside behind my house was farmland, and there's a slave cemetery on the hillside.
Well, I wish we could have more discussions. Maybe we can come back sometime. I hope you all felt like your time was worthwhile.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy it, having you.
You did a good job.
You did too.
How do we want to adjust that?
Yeah. Because I used up a lot of time on Logan.
Yeah, I
didn't
think
know if you had plans for questions.
The truth is, I couldn't see the clock behind me.
Oh.
And I have the sense, I just thought, I've gone on way too long.
But you know, I always go on way too long.
Yeah, so it's something I've guarded.
But I should
I wonder, anyway, I thought we did just about right. I think that the Chapel Hill thing is more interesting inherently, and your pictures help a lot.
We didn't talk anything about the current struggles.
Yeah, we could save some time for that.
I have a few pictures of the house, the housekeepers movement in 1980, and the march of the housekeepers after the settlement in 96, but I don't have too much on that. I mean, I know about it, but... what do you think, in my presentation, we could cut out more? Should I cut out that stuff on slavery?
No, I didn't think so.
I think you could add to yours.
What's that?
I think you could add more about the situation with 1898 now, and the anniversary and the reparations. And I don't know.
The building.
I think you should tell people about Blood Don't Sign My Name in the movie coming out. There were these riots again in Wilmington, Oxford, and places in the 1970s. There was the murder in Greensboro.
Yeah.
And, you know, we still haven't really faced up to this stuff.
Maybe I'll introduce myself. Lead with that.
Uh-huh.
Lead with the book, the movie.
Hey! I'm going to try to give him a shot.
Okay. Hey.
You have some?
Yeah.
You
room that's across from the other room.
Tim Tyson, and this is Johnny Chapman.
Hello.
We are both historians and activists and old friends. We're going to talk about the African American freedom movement in North Carolina, among other things. I've been I wrote a book called Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, which you may have heard of. Yesterday, I got to see the Hollywood movie based on this, which will be out later in the year.
Is it a fiction?
Hmm? Is it fiction? It is not. It is about, it's sort of a combination of memoir and history. When I was 10 years old, my best friend's father murdered this young black man in Oxford, North Carolina, which is about 40 miles north of here, in front of a lot of people. And our town, blew up. There was rioting and campaign of arson. Oxford's a tobacco market town, and the tobacco warehouses were set on fire. Like, you could see the fire for 20 miles, and it was four blocks from my house. So it made quite an impression on me, and I went back. I started going back when I was about your age, and I interviewed the murderer and the people, and then I got in with the people who had burned much of the town down in the rioting, and interviewed them, and interviewed the jurors and the witnesses, and then, you know, it's really a book about the civil rights movement more broadly, too. But anyway, yesterday was one of the wildest days of my life because I got to, you know, I wrote this book, it was published in 2004, but I've been working on it since, like I said, I first began working on this when I was about your age. I was writing a paper for school when I started doing research on this murder and insurrection. And then yesterday I got to see the big screen Hollywood movie. The director just brought a copy of it so I could see it and set it up at the local community college in Charlotte. So my whole family was down there, and we were watching this movie, and I was very relieved that it's actually not too bad. I was afraid it would suck. That was my... I just thought, if it's not actually a huge embarrassment, I would be so relieved. And it wasn't, so it was a lot better than that. But anyway, I brought a couple of copies of the book. You get a free autographed copy of the book if you are the person who asks the best questions. So there's a competition going on as we speak for best questions.
Tim's good.
You're actually in the lead right now because you're the only person who's asked one.
But Tim's going to be the judge.
Yeah, I'm going to be the judge. I will make an arbitrary and totally a ruthless arbitrary decision, which will have no basis in reality. So I know that many of you have not necessarily chosen to be here, and I know how that is. I've been in the jail called high school myself, so I actually quit high school, as a matter of fact. I was so fond of it. But we got some interesting stuff to talk with you about. And I want to get on to Johnny's got some wonderful pictures that I was so interested in, and what I really want to see, so I'm going to try to go quickly a little bit. When I was your age and I was learning about American history, I understood that there was something called slavery that had been before the Civil War. African Americans had been slaves. I got the sense that there was slavery and that was bad. Then we got segregation, which was bad too, but not nearly as bad. Then we got full citizenship, equality, and we were still working on that. That was sort of a short summary of what I was encouraged to believe. When I got older and began to do my own research, I discovered that wasn't true at all, and that in fact there had been a period, you know, we had the Civil War that broke down slavery, then we had full citizenship for African Americans for a number of years in Reconstruction, and then and that faltered and collapsed somewhat, but then in the 1890s in North Carolina there was the economy got so bad, a little bit like today actually, the economy sort of collapsed, and a movement grew up, and white people and black people joined in the same political movement called the Fusion Movement, and won the governor's office and both United States Senate seats, swept the whole state legislature. They won every statewide election in North Carolina. So this interracial political coalition, which called the Fusion Movement, won. The banks and the railroads and the rising industrial class really didn't want to put up with this, with any kind of regulations on them. And then two white people who were offended by the idea of black citizenship. There was a white supremacy campaign, they called it. Charles Aycock, who would soon be governor, Fernald Simmons, who would be senator for six terms, Josephus Daniels, who was the publisher of the News Observer in Raleigh, and the
one of the leading Democrats in the country. They organized this white supremacy campaign. They had a terrorist group called Red Shirts, like hundreds of guys on horseback with guns wearing these red shirts, and more or less overthrew the government of North Carolina, culminating in the Wilmington race riot of 1898. Wilmington had been the strong, Wilmington in those days, Wilmington was the biggest city in North Carolina, and it had a black majority, and it was kind of the stronghold of this fusion coalition. So the Wilmington Board of Aldermen, for example, had six white members and four black members. So they had a, they called it fusion because they were merging their political interests in this party. But anyway, in Wilmington there was a racial massacre where dozens, perhaps hundreds of people were killed. Other people, black and white, marched to the train station and vanished from North Carolina at gunpoint. And we put in, the conservatives put in all-white government, which they called permanent good government by the party of the white man, and ended up building a one-party state and taking the vote away from African Americans in 1900 at the next session of the legislature. So that was when segregation happened. That was when laws mandating, you know, separate public conveyances, separation in restaurants, water fountains, all that stuff that we associate with segregation. That stuff comes about actually in the early 20th century after the Fusion Coalition is crushed. And the Civil Rights Movement that comes along after World War II is really undoing what happened in 1898. Had any of y'all heard of the Wilmington race riot or that stuff come up?
It's an incredible great
in the US. Oh, okay. Cool.
For what?
AP US.
Great, great. At any rate, so that's really what the social order that was built in 1898, that's the one that the Civil Rights Movement was set up to topple. I wanted to talk a little bit about the most important part, what I think is probably the most important segment of the Civil Rights Movement, which begins here in North Carolina. You know, the Montgomery bus boycotts went. Anybody know?
54.
Close. 55. You got Brown versus Board of Education decision in 54, and then Montgomery in 1955. Then there's kind of nothing that you could point to as an achievement of the Civil Rights Movement for 5 years or so. There's this huge wave of terrorism across the South with bombings and shootings and beatings against people who advocated racial equality, black and white. And then, but there's nothing going on much, and nobody knows exactly how to break this stalemate that happens. And finally, the young people, four freshmen at North Carolina A&T, and members of an NAACP youth council, they go to Woolworth. Woolworth is a drugstore. Yeah, and they have a lunch counter, and the lunch counter is whites only. Anybody, of course, can buy soap and shampoo and whatnot. So these kids go in, they buy some soap and shampoo and toothpaste and stuff just to prove. At Woolworth's in Greensboro. Woolworth's is a department store.
You know Greensboro?
Yeah, Greensboro. Yeah. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
So they go into the Woolworth's, buy some stuff, and then they go sit down at the lunch counter and order lunch and won't move. And the Woolworth's won't serve them. But of course, they're taking up space and they don't. The authorities don't quite know what to do. The second day, there's 25 of them. The third day, there's 65 of them. The fourth day, there are hundreds. And one of my favorite scenes in the Civil Rights Movement occurs on the fourth day. There were white kids who came as well, on the fourth day. These are all college students in Greensboro. Some high school students begin to join in. But these white hoodlums come, and they're kind of thuggish guys, and they block the door, and they won't let people in, and they're pushing and shoving and calling people names. And so the kids from North Carolina A&T go and get the football team, or a large subset of the football team, which forms this kind of flying wedge, and they just thunder up to the door, boom, and push aside, just like it was a kickoff, and form a funnel so that people can get into Woolworths, and the hundreds come in, and they take up all the seats. They're dressed in their Sunday best. People wear ties and dresses and gloves, and they bring their books to study, and they take turns, they take in shifts so that people can go back and go to class, and they just keep all the schools occupied so that Woolworths can't make any money. And within a few days, it spreads to Durham and Chapel Hill and Raleigh. Within a few months, it spread to Nashville and Atlanta and all across the South. Within a couple of years, it's happened in hundreds of different communities. And this is really the heart of the civil rights movement. This is what brings nonviolent direct action, to blossom. And one thing I would just mention, in case you should know that the people who did this were really folks your age and not much older, and none of the grown-ups were in favor of this. Like Martin Luther King wasn't even in favor of the sit-ins at first. After they began to work like crazy, they won the support of civil rights leaders. But at first, nobody was for this. This was really a youth movement of young people taking initiative. And it just caught on and really helped break the back of segregation. Any questions about that before we... So this is begins in 1960. The sit-ins start February 1st, 1960, and they carry on, you still see a sit-in once in a while, but real, real strongly for about 3 years.
Until the Civil Rights Act is passed, right?
Yeah, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is in response to nonviolent direct action campaigns. In Birmingham especially. So the sit-ins became a sort of a standard part of the movement's repertoire. And that's when you get, after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, is when you get the signs like white and color come down and public accommodations are open. I remember segregation, so to me it's really actually recent history. I'll be 50 soon, but when I was the first movie I went to was segregated. I remember going to the movie theater on Saturday morning, and black people had to sit in the balcony, and they didn't have separate theaters. Everybody went to the same theater, but black people had to sit in the balcony. They had to buy their ticket at the front, then go around the building and go up this staircase. Yeah.
White people who was poor and they
know.
Yeah, white trash is just a term, not unlike the N-word, except it's just applied for whites. The whole point of all that, you know, the point of it's not about water, you know. It's not about who gets to drink out of what fountain. That's to teach black people that they're inferior, right? That's to teach them there's something wrong with them, that they don't belong, and that they are to stay in their place. And it's to teach white people the same thing, that blacks are inferior. And of course, people who are, you know what Tar Heel means? What's it mean? Close, very close, very close. Actually, very close. Poor people worked in the what was called naval stores, turpentine, pitch, tar. The way you make tar is you take pine sap, and you do this like in August, and you cut holes in pine trees, catch the sap, and then boil it under a fire. If you can imagine tending a fire in August in the pine woods, it's about the worst work you can possibly imagine, and it makes your feet black. And Tar Heel was a term that meant white trash. If you were a Tar Heel, that was like being a people you used to work in. People used to work in cotton mills. That, you know, the air in a cotton mill is full of lint from the cotton, and it gets in your hair if you work there, and they were called lint heads. Farmers who work in the sun are called rednecks, right? From a sunburn on your head. So these are kind of, this means the same thing as white trash. But anyway, it's just a name. That's the purpose of all that, is to teach the lower class whites that at least they're better than blacks, because they can use the white water fountain. They can ride in the front of the bus. But it's really about keeping the system together, not about who rides where.
Yes?
I think the reason that they use it as a sports team is it depends on your story. But during either the American Revolution, under Nathaniel Greene, or during the Civil War, there was a Virginia Battalion and a North Carolina Battalion, and the two battalions were just like grossly outnumbered. The Virginia Battalion was kind of left and the North Carolina Battalion held. So the old taunt there was put some tar on your heels and maybe you'll be able to stick.
Yeah. That's the very good rendition of the fairy tale. But yeah, I learned that one too. But really actually Tar Heel is a term of class denigration, there are several stories that you did very well that they are used as the substitute for the actual truth of the matter. Anyway, I really do I need to do something else? I really want to see Johnny's slides. Yanni's going to talk a little bit about the movement here in Chapel Hill, and has some interesting stuff to share with us.
How long do we have, Joanne?
You have until 10:00.
Okay, so we've got about a half an hour.
You have to speak up a little bit for me, because my hearing's not all that great, okay? And just so you know where I'm coming from, I grew up rich, white, Protestant, male, northern, Shaker Heights, Ohio. Went to a private school, didn't know any black people except for maids in the neighborhood and black yardmen who come and cut grass and stuff. I didn't have a clue at all about anything else in the world but my little fairy tale bubble. And actually, TV didn't do much to help that, because it was all, you know, this was the 1950s when I was growing up. It was all racial stereotypes and gender stereotypes. wasn't until I got out in the world that I had any clue what was going on. And so then I ended up being in high school and college during the 1960s, where it's this huge movement. You can't even imagine how big it was. But it helped people like me understand that I had been privileged and sheltered, and that if I really wanted to do some good in the world, I needed to change that. So I got out and I educated myself and worked in working class jobs and came to Atlanta and North Carolina to do organizing. So I was one of those children of the 60s, not a hippie. Could you get the door? And I have, I came to Chapel Hill area to work in about 1975. And from that time on, I was doing grassroots organizing, which by that I mean, you know, workers at the hospital, tenant organizations, welfare rights organizations, police brutality stuff, you name it. I was involved in all of that. And then in 1990, for a variety of reasons, I decided to go to graduate school and try to retrieve the history of the black community in Chapel Hill, which I knew a lot about it because people had told me stories, but it wasn't recorded anywhere. And black people were pretty much left out of Chapel Hill's history or the university's history. And so that's what I've devoted myself to for the last 20 years, and been doing organizing and research and writing ever since then. So I wrote my master's thesis, which was actually a very long thesis, on the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill, which is why I know about it. And then I wrote my dissertation just a couple of years ago on black freedom in the University of North Carolina, because you know, you think of UNC as being a liberal institution, being diverse and all that, but the whole history of UNC is that it was the leading slave owner institution in the state, you know, up until the end of slavery. It was the leading white supremacy institution in the state up until at least the 1950s, when it started to be forced to desegregate. And now on the surface of it, it looks a lot better, and in some ways it is better. It's more inclusive in the student body and the faculty and so forth. But the way black workers and other workers of color now are treated at the university is pretty much like it was during segregation and Jim Crow. So that part hasn't changed. There's diversity, but there really isn't very much justice. And that's actually true of Chapel Hill as a whole, and I hope that you all realize that, but you probably don't, unless you've had that direct experience yourself. So anyways, let me just talk about the civil rights movement and show you some pictures, but I'm going to start off with slavery. Okay, this one is from a newspaper back in the 1800s. And you might not be able to read it, but it says Andrew Mitchell has a bunch of valuable slaves, and they'll be auctioned off in Chapel Hill. So we had slavery here in Chapel Hill. Can you see it? We had slavery in Chapel Hill. Slave owners were half the population of Chapel Hill. The other half was black, pretty much. Well, actually, slave owners were about a quarter of the population of Chapel Hill. The other quarter of the white population, the other half of the black white population, was skilled workers mostly. There were no poor white people in Chapel Hill, hardly at all. And all of the laboring people were black, and most of them were slaves. And if you ever do some history, this is the manuscript census. And this is how slaves were listed in 1850 in Chapel Hill. And this guy's a professor. He was the one who started the UNC Law School battle. Battle Land in Chapel Hill is named for him. A lot of battles in Chapel Hill. That means one slave, 50 years old, male, black. No names. Slaves were never listed anywhere with names. And often they only had first names. And if you go and look at the slave tombstones in the Chapel Hill Cemetery, pretty much all you'll see is a rock. It's called a fieldstone. It's put up like that. There's no name on it. A lot of the slaves who are buried there don't even have gravestones. This is how the tradition of black invisibility and inferiority was started and impressed upon white people and black people. You didn't count for anything. You didn't have a name. All you were in the census was a slash mark. You didn't have a name on your grave. You were just a rock, if you had a name. Now, one interesting thing here is that this slave up here belonged to Yancey, 57-year-old male, and that's an M. Anybody guess what that stands for? D for black, M for what?
Minority.
Mulatto. You know the term mulatto? Anybody know?
Half white.
Not necessarily half and half, but it's like half and half. So, how does a black slave from Africa get white blood? Who said what?
I said rape.
You said rape. I was going to say it was a four-letter word beginning with R. Rape. This was a common, you may not hear about it too much, but this was a very, very common thing. Slave owners, women, slaves were property. They had no rights. They couldn't refuse the slave owner. He wanted to have sex. He had sex. No big deal. It was even profitable for him, right? Get the lead. Okay, so all this slavery and the history that Tim told you about, the struggle for black freedom during Reconstruction and the vote, the struggle for white supremacy to counteract that black freedom, that resulted in the system we call Jim Crow, which existed in Chapel Hill as a legal and normal way of life where black and white people were totally separated and unequal. Black people were demeaned, treated just like they were during slavery, pretty much. And so one of the main features of Jim Crow was not just neighborhood segregation or separate schools or separate drinking fountains. It was the fact that black people couldn't get good jobs. Black people weren't allowed to work at skilled jobs or supervisory jobs or secretarial jobs at the university. They had to be menial laborers, almost all of them, 90-some percent. So that meant they were groundskeepers, housekeepers, cafeteria workers, stuff like that. In the community, what people did, the university was the biggest employer, but white faculty and other white people in Chapel Hill all had black servants. In fact, that was one of the ways that the university recruited.
The picture's upside down.
Yeah, thank you. Is that better?
Yeah.
I get a little confused with this. I have low tech skills. But, one of the ways that the university recruited professors, because UNC did not pay as much as northern schools, but one of the things that they could offer was very cheap black servants. And this was one of the big inducements to coming and being a professor. You know, you could get cheap black workers for a whole lot less than you could up north. So these kinds of conditions and these confinements to these low-paid jobs and this demeaning way of being treated, you know, black people who worked at the university or in someone's homes were not called Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so. They were called Tom or Aunt Sally or something like that. It was all very demeaning. Black people were really trying to shelter their kids. They were so embarrassed by their work situation that they hardly ever allowed kids to come to the job or talk about their work. So young children were sheltered from Jim Crow and segregation. They had separate black schools. And as Tim said, you know, there was the bubbling up of the civil rights movement in the 1950s, but it took a spark in 1960 to really get things going, and that was the sit-in movement in Greensboro. In Chapel Hill, and all these sit-ins spread around the state and the South in areas where there were black colleges or universities, and black college students tended to lead these movements. It wasn't the adults. Now, in Chapel Hill, we had no black college or university. There was a few black college students at UNC, just like in 15 or 20. Who led the movement in Chapel Hill? Anybody know? The Civil Rights Movement. That's what we're talking about. High school students. High school students. No, actually, there was almost no white high school students involved in the Civil Rights Movement in Chapel Hill, which is something that I haven't quite figured out yet. The local white families, I think, did not allow their kids to participate in the movement. It was led by black high school students from Lincoln High School. 15 to 18 years old, your age. It's a good example of how young people can change the world. You don't have to wait till you're old and knowledgeable and have your place in society and stuff. Young people have always taken the lead and changed the world. So that's something you should understand and know. That's part of your history and your legacy. So, let's see if I can get this right now. Let's see. That letter, yes. This gives you a sense. This is the front page of the local paper. And it gives you a sense of how big the civil rights movement was in Chapel Hill. This wasn't the biggest march. The biggest march was about 500, but they were like weekly, once or twice or three times a week. And there were sit-ins and there were arrests. There was nearly 1,000 arrests in Chapel Hill. High school students, some black college students. There were a lot of white college students who joined in with the black high school students and formed a coalition. Said walk out of stage by Negro students. That's at Lincoln High School. They walked out of their own high school because even though it was a black school, it was controlled by a white school board. And there was pressure put on their principal and their teachers to not let them go out during the day and participate in the movement. So they walked out in protest about it. That's how old a lot of the students were who led the movement. That's Mary Mason. She was the first president of the Chapel Hill Freedom Movement. And that's when she was in high school. She actually got admitted to UNC in the early 1960s and would have been the first black woman at UNC. But even though her father worked a very good job for a black person, which is being a houseboy at one of the fraternities. They didn't have enough money to send her to college. So she, I mean, to UNC. So she went to North Carolina Central. Both of her kids have graduated from UNC. So that's one of the gains of the civil rights movement. This shows a protest in a sit-in. You can see there's some white college students in there, are there? The police. These things happened like every night in 1963 for weeks upon weeks. This gives you a sense of what kind of people were in the march. You know, those are high school students in the front there, quite a few of them. There's one white professor back here, Al Ammon, I think, white student. You know, a number of white people supporting the demonstrations in Chapel Hill. But a little bit different than some other parts of North Carolina. There was a lot of really young people involved in the movement. These are just little kids. Maybe that's their sister there. You know, they would sometimes come as families. And homemade signs, lots of enthusiasm. There were also older people who participated. And, you know, as Tim said, the older generation didn't support the civil rights movement at first. But once their kids started getting arrested, they jumped in, right? And the older, more conservative leaders also pretty much came around. This is the first really big demonstration in Chapel Hill, about 500 people. I don't know why it says Eden Joe's. Was that a national slogan or a... Where did that come from? I don't know.
I don't know. I've never seen this slogan before.
Okay. Jim talked about the AFG football team forming that flying wedge. This guy right here was on the A&T football team and was part of the Flying Wedge. His name was Fred Battle. He's descended from the Battle professor who was the slave owner in Chapel Hill. His eyes are green. And he's also, for a long time, was the head of the Chapel Hill NAACP, and, you know, one of the main black leaders in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill movement was not peaceful. These are how they piled up the demonstrators in piles like that. And you see they were all trained in nonviolence. They were totally nonviolent, limp, stuff like that. But back here, these are all a bunch of angry white guys, probably from Carborough. And the police are sort of keeping them in check. And this police officer, I don't know what he's doing, but probably saying, stay in your place. Some of the segregationists were extremely nasty and violent. This is James Fushi, who was a high school student. He had just been in a sit-in in one of the small stores, and the owner of the store had locked the door on the demonstrators, and he had taken ammonia, which is a really vile, nasty smelling, choking smelling, burning kind of cleaning agent that you mop floors with and stuff, poured it down this guy's throat and all over his face, and he got like second degree burns and had to be hospitalized and stuff. And James Fushi went on to be one of the leaders of the movement and left Chapel Hill and went around with Martin Luther King. People in the Chapel Hill movement were very brave. This is Big John Caldwell and one of his sons bodily throwing a limp James Britton out the door of Columbia Drugstore, which is over near where the Chapel Hill Wine Bar is now. And this guy pulled out cattle prods on people to carry a gun. Of course, the FBI helped him along by telling him that all of these demonstrators, they weren't the good Chapel Hill Negroes. They were being stirred up by communists from San Francisco. And they were dangerous. He needed to arm himself. Like, they were the most nonviolent people in the world. They wouldn't even press charges against any of these people who did stuff to them. That was not nonviolent. James Britton was 15. He was one of the planners of the first sit-in in Chapel Hill, which occurred in February 28, 1960. The movement in Chapel Hill went from targeting small businesses and really violent segregationists to targeting the Merchants Association. This was the first big sit-in of 1963, and they targeted the Merchants Association because it seemed as though the merchants were the ones who were really against passing a civil rights ordinance, a local ordinance in Chapel Hill, which would have been the first open public accommodations law in the South. Well, it turned out that even just targeting the merchants wasn't enough, because Jim Crow and segregation was very hard to crack in Chapel Hill. The university really put its weight behind segregation and refused to support the students and the demonstrators. And so eventually the movement turned on the whole town and the university. And this was February 1st, when the civil rights movement was at its peak in Chapel Hill, about February 1st, 1964. And hundreds and hundreds of demonstrators blocked the big roadways in and out of Chapel Hill, and blocked the exit from the parking for the Wake Forest basketball game. And that's what you see here, is this woman trying to get her car out, and the demonstrators here, including this guy, Harold Foster, who was the young leader of the movement in Chapel Hill for many years. And they didn't win the public accommodations law here in Chapel Hill, but they did join in the efforts of hundreds and hundreds of communities all across the South and in the North too. And that forced the federal government to enact the civil rights legislation in 64 and the Voting Rights Act. And even though the leaders of our local movement were sentenced to a year in jail, which was a very harsh prison term, North Carolina jails are no fun. And that sort of broke the back of our local movement. But in the end, the collective efforts of everybody who participated in this vast, massive movement, which is almost unlike anything that's ever taken place in the world, won civil rights and broke down the legal aspects of Jim Crow, segregation by law. What they didn't break down was the ongoing sort of undercover white supremacy and Jim Crow kind of attitudes and employment practices and things in the schools and all that.
So the James Fushi, did he have get children and stuff? Because I know it might be the same. There's a Fushi family here.
There's tons of Fushis here.
So are they still part of the main, are they still that same family?
Yeah.
Yeah.
James Fushi, Braxton Fushi, Charles Fushi.
I know.
James, yeah. They're all part of the same family, and they were all involved in civil rights. Yeah, Fushis are a big name. A lot of these people who were involved in the civil rights movement are still here in Chapel Hill. But because things really didn't change in a lot of ways, particularly employment, there's been an ongoing struggle ever since the 60s to fight against the legacy of Jim Crow. And this is a headline from 1996-7. And there was a big movement of the housekeeping workers at UNC against demeaning treatment by white supervisors, low pay, overwork, and lack of employment opportunities. And they led a movement for about 6 or 7 years. It's actually still going on. And they won a $1 million lawsuit settlement against the university. That, you know, gave people pay raises and a whole variety of other things. So that actually was a forced admission on the part of the university that it continued to have Jim Crow kinds of employment practices. And we're struggling with that whole situation still today at the university, in the community, with the minority achievement gap and all of that. So that's the end of my presentation. We only have a few minutes left if folks want to talk about it or have some questions. Great to have some enthusiasm.
I was wondering what everybody thinks when you walk around campus, because I just graduated from Carolina, and I've always found that some of the building names are really problematic. Daniel's Student Stores would be one of them, naming a building after a governor who's known for lynching and overthrowing the government and all of that. Why do you think that the Student Stores is, you know, across the street from the Sonya Haynes Black Cultural Center? It seems almost like they put these buildings in odd spots. They keep these names on them. You know, some of the names they change, sometimes they don't.
Mostly they don't change the names, but we've had a lot of struggles over the building names. Particularly Saunders Hall, which is a 1924 building named after a leader of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina. He didn't give a lot of money to the university or anything. He was just prominent. Just like Tim said, the six governors after 1898 were all part of the white supremacy movement. That was the popular thing to be. And so our buildings were named after. And most of these people were all UNC trustees. UNC actually led the white supremacy movement. I mean, it was like a project, a UNC project. And so there's tons of buildings named after these white supremacists and slave owners. And nobody who was a white administrator at the university thought twice about this. But naturally, black people didn't like it. And, you know, we started using those building names to point out the continuing institutional racism. And the Daniels Building was built in the early 1970s, I think, early 70s. And so this was well after the Civil Rights Movement, and yet they knew that this guy was a white supremacist, and they still named it for him.
Is it named after Josephus or Jonathan?
It's named after both of them. So if they can get a little bit of wiggle room there, to Jonathan and
the Yeah, the street side shows the full name, and it's Joseph Daniels. So I don't know if the pit side shows that.
Yeah, Joseph, he was like the leader of the white supremacy movement in North Carolina. The Sonya Stone Center is a good example of the buildings that are popping up on the university campus that are named after black people. There's not very many. But the Stone Center was the result of a huge struggle during the 1990s to get a Black Cultural and History Center named after the beloved black professor, Sonya Stone. And there's now some George Moses Horton Hall named after a slave. As a result of that housekeeper struggle, there was the laundry was renamed for Rebecca Clark and Keenan Chief. But the point about all this is that every single one of these moves on the part of the university has been forced by protest. It's not something that they've been dragged kicking and screaming into this. And they don't want to talk about that, but that's what our movement has been about locally for quite a few years now, along with the wages and the schools and so on and so forth. So they are very problematic, and the problem with Saunders Hall in particular, the way I see it, is that it doesn't tell honestly who Saunders was. It gives you some sort of glowing information about who they say he was and what he did. He was Secretary of State, blah, blah, blah. But they don't tell you that he was a white supremacist and led the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina, and he was on the executive committee of the Board of Trustees. So it's hidden history, it's suppressed. And my guess is you probably haven't all learned about this in school very much, maybe a little bit in AP history. But we're trying to get the schools here, and maybe you can do something about it, to add to their curriculum the local history of African Americans and the struggle for freedom and justice. Are we going to give out a prize?
Yeah, that's going to ring in about a minute, so.
So our teacher's got it.
Come on, someone's got to trump in with the teacher's question.
Yeah, there's still time for another good question.
Yeah,
right there, yeah.
In recent years, do you think that some aspects of the discrimination have moved more on a social and economic basis?
It's a good question. There's a lot of discussion that around the country, you know, they talk about the end of race and the lessening importance of race and more of class now. So, for instance, you have low-wage workers at the university who are now no longer all black. They're black, Latino, and Asian. They're still all people of color. So the point about class and race, socioeconomic stuff, is there's always been discrimination based on class, on socioeconomic things, right? In Chapel Hill in particular, and in the United States, and particularly the southern United States, those two things of race and class have been together because, like I said, Jim Crow forced nearly all black people into a laboring caste. So if you deal with issues that black
people... Okay, then it marks the end of the second session. We do have another 10-minute passing. The next session is going to start at 11:20. I'll ring the bell to end this one, and then I'll ring the bell to start the next one.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And I hope we can do more sometimes.
It's a pleasure.
What was your name?
My name's Mon.
What?
My name's Mon Hogan. Gosh, you want to say here? You want to play? I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here.
We have to
thank you so much, and congratulations on all that. You know, it hasn't been out for long, but it seems to have.
Bring your French plastic, some one of these advances.
Thank you so much. Good luck.
Good stuff. I was a substitute teacher for one day. One day I just couldn't. They were only 7th grade, but I couldn't handle them at all.
I've been in high school a lot, but it always wears on my equilibrium.
My God, I can't.
I've got a terrible temper.
What?
Yeah.
It's just bad.
The pair of sunglasses that was traveling around the room almost. It's odd if we'd like to snatch that. Snatch it. Still, that was all right.
I love the way our stories are coming together when it's coming out. That's really cool.
I saw Freddie Sanger.
So you've been going to Dips, or?
Yeah, I go to Dips every year.
Who else has been showing up?
Well, Fred's always there.
Eugene
only once that when I was there.
Nate,
pretty consistently. Al, pretty consistently. The guy who's in the state legislature, his name's Larry.
Larry Paul.
Comes, you know, pretty much. Met a guy named Ernie out there.
Ernie Robbins.
Yeah.
Interesting. Ernie was aerospace physicist and came here to the camp. He was out in, you know, retirement. And he tried to do things. He's not totally plugged in.
She's sending me these messages.
Caitlin?
Caitlin.
Just that stayed in the whole session.
Yeah, she's. River Battle is coming to my class. I know, but I heard another thing. River Barber.
Uh-huh.
He's coming to my class tomorrow night.
What class is that?
It's called
that
South and Black and White Fit. Hey there, Caitlin, how you doing?
Hey, Caitlin.
Yanni says hello. We're out at the high school doing the program on the civil rights movement in North Carolina. But anyway, we're on break. It's going all right. But I gotta go fast. So tonight is it's from 7:15 to 9:30. It's at the Center for Documentary Studies. Do you know where it is? It's 1317 West Pettigrew. It's across the main street.
Are you guys here for civil rights or feminism? Civil rights or feminism?
Freedom
Side? Yeah.
We're here. Wait, he said he would come. Is he slipping the slide on where they have to come?
Alright.
And Al said he would come too. I don't know what to say. What happens tonight is really different. It's
not double.
It's not
so, yeah.
Come on in. Anybody got any candy or food? I'm starving. I'd get up in time for breakfast.
Thank you.
So how many of you were here by choice?
I'm not sure.
So this was your choice. I know someone got assigned.
Yeah. Most all of us.
Yeah.
Got captive audience. So that's okay.
So we got a teacher come?
Yeah, two.
Ah.
So, I know we look
very youthful pictures.
That's right.
When do we start?
11:20.
11:20,
Seconds from now, there'll be a...
Yeah, he'll announce when the session
I was 10 years old, I lived in Oxford, North Carolina, about 30, 40 miles from here. And my best friend's father murdered this young black man in front of a lot of people, like a lot in public. And we had a little war. We had an arson campaign. Much of the downtown area was burned down. These tobacco warehouses, like the size of this high school, made of wood and filled with tobacco, a known flammable substance, burned up. You can see the fires for 20 miles, and we were four blocks from there. So it made quite an impression on me. And when I got older, when I was about your age, I started asking people about the things that had happened, the murder and the trial. My friend's father was acquitted, even though this was not a murder mystery in any way. But, and then the arson and the demonstrations and the Ku Klux Klan rallies and the shooting that went on in Oxford. I began asking questions about all that when I was about your age. And when I was in my first year in college, I went and interviewed the murderer. I tried to write a paper for school about this murder and this racial trouble. I was trying to figure out what had happened and why things were the way they were. When I was in high school, one of my best friends was stabbed to death in the bathroom at school in a racial fight that he had started. And we had riots, and we had cops at school, and school was pretty dangerous, and it was rough because the schools integrated when I was in the seventh grade, and when I was in high school, things were still pretty tough at school, and lots and lots of trouble. And I think in some ways, I knew that it was connected to what had happened back in Oxford, that if I could understand that. So I went back and interviewed the murderer. And then I interviewed the people who had burned the town. I got lucky and found them. And so my paper for school actually got published as a book a few years ago, which autographed copy of is will be given to the person who asked the best question in this session. But yesterday I got to watch a Hollywood movie based on this book. This past summer, we filmed a movie starring Nate Parker and Ricky Schroeder and a bunch of other folks. But anyway, yesterday I finally got to see it. It'll be out later this year. But,
can I ask?
Sure, absolutely.
What year was that? Because I'm from close to Henderson, so I know Austin.
1970.
Oh, okay. I'm going to ask my mom, that's her hometown, my dad is from Henderson.
Yes, so you could write the same book about Henderson.
Somebody at the door.
Anyway, that's what got me interested in trying to figure out how things got the way they were. And so I went back and learned about slavery and Reconstruction. I guess when I was in school, I heard a little bit about slavery. And I understood. It's funny, the story that I had in my head that I was sort of encouraged to believe in school was that slavery, was way back there. And that was really bad. And then there was segregation, which was less bad, And then there was equality and full citizenship, which we were sort of still working out. But so you see things always getting better. But in fact, that wasn't true at all. We start out, as a slave society. Then the Civil War that broke that up. Then we had a period of full citizenship for African Americans who could vote and hold office and be free and equal, and then that sort of collapsed. And then at the turn of the 20th century, in the 1890s, we had what was called the Fusion Movement in North Carolina, where blacks who wanted to be full citizens joined with whites who were upset about the economy. It was a period not unlike this one, because the economy is
sort of collapsed in the 1890s. And people were very upset. Lots of them were losing their land to the banks. So they formed this movement to try to improve things called the Fusion Movement, which was a black and white political coalition. And they won. They had a huge majority in North Carolina. And they ended up winning the governor's office and both Senate seats and the whole legislature. They won every statewide election, this interracial coalition. And then we had what was called the White Supremacy Campaign, which was organized by Charles Aycock, who would later be governor, on the back of this movement. The White Supremacy Campaign used violence. They had a group called the Red Shirts, who were like hundreds of guys on horseback with guns, with wearing red shirts. They were killing people who stood up for racial equality. Anyway, they more or less overthrew the government in North Carolina and took the vote away from blacks, so that the whites who had sided with blacks had nowhere to go politically, because by themselves they were extremely a minority. So that's when we got segregation. It was actually, 50 years after the fall of slavery, when the White Supremacy campaigns won and took over North Carolina and put in a one-party state and took the vote away from blacks. And then that was the social order. That was when you get laws against, where you get separate drinking fountains, where you get separate theaters, where you get separate places on public transportation, when you get this society in which all the menial labor is done by black people who are not allowed to have good jobs, which are reserved for whites. And you get these separate places. So that's really how that came about. And I wanted to talk just a little bit about how that changed. I know you've probably heard about the Montgomery bus boycott and Rosa Parks and the rise of Martin Luther King. But that's when? Do you remember, anybody remember the date? It's 1955, actually, is the bus boycott. You get the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which made school segregation unconstitutional, in 1954. And then in 1955, Rosa Parks won't get up off the bus, and a movement emerges in Montgomery which gives rise to Martin Luther King. That's in 1955. But then you get nothing for years, actually. There was a stalemate where there's this huge white organizing against the civil rights movement, and then a lot of terrorism against people who believe in racial equality, and not much progress. But then in 1960, February 1st, 1960, so it's 5 years after the Montgomery bus boycott, four students at North Carolina A&T in Greensboro go into a lunch counter at the Woolworths. The department stores in those days, where you bought just about everything, would have a lunch counter, but the lunch counter was for whites only. And so what they did was they went in, but anybody could buy stuff. So they went and bought soap and shampoo, toothpaste and stuff, so they could show that they were actual customers. And then they went and sat down at the lunch counters and asked to be served, which they were refused, but they wouldn't move. So the first day was just the four of them, but the second day there were 25. And the third day there were 63. And the fourth day there were hundreds. And obviously Woolworths can't make money with hundreds of demonstrators in there, right? And taking up all the seats at the lunch counter. And it was just amazing, these young people, really not much older than yourselves, who they would go in, they dressed very nicely. This was sort of a political show, they dressed very nicely, they had ties and dresses and gloves, the girls in white gloves, and they would take their books and go and sit at the lunch counter and study and take turns so that they could go to classes. And this was to put economic pressure on the department stores. Anyway, this spread. I mean, first it's just Greensboro, but it starts on Monday, and by the end of the week, these things are happening in Raleigh, and Durham, and Charlotte, and then they start spreading across the whole South. And within a couple of years, they've happened in hundreds of communities. And it's really, this is the civil rights movement. In many ways, it's the young people. And the really interesting thing about it is that none of the old people were in favor of this at all. I mean, even the civil rights leaders, like Martin Luther King, was not really in favor of the sit-in movement until after it had been going for a couple of weeks. And they began to get excited. But at first, this is just young people acting on their own and without support and approval from the older people. And it was a creative idea, you know. So don't ever doubt that you can change the world, because this really is the most important phase of the civil rights movement. I just want to tell you one quick story about one of my favorite moments in the civil rights movement. It happens on that thing starts on Monday. On Thursday, that's when you get hundreds of people out there after being going for a few days. And you get some white kids coming out supporting the sit-in, too. But there were also some white people, these thugs and hoodlums, who were really upset about it. And they got around the door and were trying to keep everybody from going in. And they were pushing people and hitting people and stuff. And so the students from North Carolina A&T went back, which is the black college in Greensboro, went back and got the football team. And so, because they couldn't get inside, and so the football team just forms this like flying wedge and goes do 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 do, just like it was a kickoff, and they just run right up to the door through all the and make a funnel of bodies and just break all the way to the door, and that way the demonstrators can get inside and take all the seats. And one of the hoodlums said, "Who the hell do y'all think you are?" And one of the football players said, "With the Union Army." It's just a funny moment, but also one that shows you it's a little more complicated than just nonviolence. But anyway, Yanni has got some great pictures of the civil rights movement in North Carolina and some other things to tell you about. Feel free to interrupt the questions at any time.
I don't have any questions. Tim, before I get going.
Yeah, I just want to ask real quick. Are you familiar with SNCC?
Oh, yes.
Student Nonviolent
Coalition? Yes. I think I should have mentioned it, because the student nonviolent, what happens in 1960, like this stuff spreads for weeks and weeks, and it spreads all across the South. Ella Baker from North Carolina, who's this wonderful activist woman, she realized that the young people, that this something special was happening. So she called a conference at Shaw University in Raleigh, and they brought the sit-in people, came from all across the South, and came to Raleigh and organized the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which ends up being probably the most influential organization in the civil rights movement, and born right here in North Carolina. And that it's a direct, what the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was an effort to give a kind of institutional organization to this movement that was spread. So, yeah, that's where that came from.
Yeah, I'd ask because in high school I attended a couple of academically oriented camps at Central, yes. And they were coordinated, I forget his name, but he was one of the main coordinators of SNCC. Person
who's
running those camps,
and he would tell us about
it. Wow. What a privilege. Any other questions? Well, my name is Yanni Chapman. Yanni's a nickname. Is my middle name, which is Kenyon, and I had my life experience was nothing at all like Tim's, except for being white, you know, and male, and Protestant. against this at all. Mark's a privilege no matter what part of the country you grew up in, but I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, in a wealthy suburb, went to a private boys school, all the privileges in the world, lived in a little bubble until I was at least a teenager, didn't even know that the whole world wasn't just like how I lived. Only black people, I can't say I knew them, but I saw them, they came into our community as maids. Had traveled from their homes in the ghetto in Cleveland on the, what we call the rapid transit, like a public. And it had been built by the rich people who developed the suburb to bring workers out from the city and to take businessmen into the city. So every morning you'd see all these black maids getting off of the rapid transit and walking to their jobs. And you see all these white guys with briefcases getting on the rapid transit and going, you know, down to the Terminal Tower, which was the main business building. So that was one of the experiences that I puzzled over. I had nothing as exciting as, you know, Tim's experiences, and I really didn't learn, I didn't know anything about segregation until the civil rights movement in the country sort of forced it on my to my attention. And for whatever reason, I wanted to get involved. And so I wanted to get involved in the civil rights movement in 1964, the summer of 64, which probably would have meant going to Mississippi, you know, for Freedom Summer, which would have undoubtedly transformed my life. But my mother said, "No, you're not doing that." And she set up an alternative thing for me to go out to South Dakota to be on an Indian reservation doing some kind of volunteer work. And that actually was a very big mistake on her part to try to keep me from getting involved, because I learned about the history of the genocide and mistreatment of Indians in this country. And I saw the incredible poverty that Indians lived in and the discrimination that they faced every day. And I also, I learned that it wasn't okay to be a well-to-do white person to go and help people, you know, as if you were better and you knew what to do, and you were having this patronizing attitude, you're gonna help people. The young Indian guys put a dead rattlesnake on our doorstep, you know, one of the first days we were there. And then the next day, we didn't have running water out there. They had the Indians drove a truck about 3 miles on this dusty road to go pick up water in a big container for us each day. And of course we didn't really appreciate that, but the water showed up every day. But the next day after the rattlesnake, the water was full of salt. And we sort of pondered, what was this all about? And luckily I had a friend out there, a woman named Chelis Glendening, who's actually a pretty well-known author now, an activist. And she was friends with some of the Indian guys, and she told me, you know, what the deal was. And so that's why I started getting educated, that if you're going to be involved, you know, you've got to be involved from a point of view of equality and solidarity. And especially if you're a white guy who's privileged, you know, in so many different ways, race, sex, gender, class, everything, you have to really learn. So I really devoted myself to learning how to change my attitudes and my outlook. And I was part of the student movement at Harvard in the 1960s, and as a result I got into organizing, and I came south to organize. And that's how I ended up in Chapel Hill, and I moved to this area in about 1975, and I worked as a lab tech at the hospital, and I did grassroots organizing. you know, welfare rights, labor organizing, tenant organizing, all kinds of things like that. And so I get to know folks in the black community from the hospital and from my organizing work. And I heard all these stories about the civil rights movement, especially, and the conditions that people faced on the job still at that time, which were pretty grim, full of discrimination. Even in the 70s and 80s, the hospital was very, very nasty and discriminatory. I drew blood, and I had a white patients that I was drawing blood from for a blood transfusion. They would say, "Now you make sure that I don't get a black person blood." Right? I mean, this was just the kinds of attitudes that were pretty open and prevalent still in those days, even after the civil rights movement. In any case, I ended up in 1990 deciding to go to graduate school and retrieve this history that had been suppressed and had been distorted and censored about the university and the town. And so I wrote my master's thesis in 1995 on the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill, and then my dissertation in 2006 on black freedom in the University of North Carolina. I don't know what y'all teach, but if it has anything to do with history or civics, there's some good material in there you could use. So that's why I know what I know. I continue to do organizing. I work with the NAACP, and I've done a lot of organizing as well as academic work. I want to share with you some slides, pictures here. Let's see. I never get this right. Okay. That down in the corner there is extracted from a 19th century Chapel Hill newspaper. It advertises the sale of slaves by Andrew Mickle, who was the bursar at the university. And it's in Chapel Hill. This just lets you know that Chapel Hill was a slave society. About half the population of Chapel Hill was black, mostly slaves, and half was white. And about half of the white people were slave owners. The rest were skilled workers. There was almost no poor white people in Chapel Hill. The rich white people didn't want them. They liked to have black servants. Some people don't think Chapel Hill had slaves because, you know, it's got the reputation for being a liberal town. This is the way slaves were enumerated in the census back in 1850. On the left is the name of the slave owner. Slaves had no names, legally. I mean, the slave was not called John Brown. The slave was called John, or Zach, or Caesar, or Sophie, or whatever. People didn't use last names for slaves. They were anonymous. That's a slash mark, or what might have been a name. So this gives their age: 50, 11, 4, 30, 3 years old, 1 year old, 48 years old. This is their sex, male and female. And this is their color. All of these are beads. Black. This is the name for what? A lot of them. You know what a lot of them mean? The student? A lot of them?
Like mixed of white and black.
Right, mixed white and black. So, how does a slave from Africa get white blood mixed in? Four letter word begins with R.
Great.
This was one of the common practices of slavery. It happened in Chapel Hill, just like everywhere else. The slave owner, his property was the slave woman. He could do whatever he wanted. Sometimes people did resist, but they often get whipped or killed if they did. And usually they had to bear the master's children. And this was even an economic advantage to the master because the children of a woman who was a slave were automatically slaves, whether they were mixed race or not. And he could sell that kid or do what, and they often did that. So, this whole history of slavery and then what Tim told you about, the struggle for black freedom after the Civil War, the crushing of Reconstruction, the development of this biracial political thing in North Carolina, the fusion movement, and then the crushing of that by the white supremacy campaign, and a disfranchisement by a constitutional amendment for North Carolina. This brought about what we call Jim Crow, which was a period of really forced, violent, extreme segregation in all aspects of life, where black people were demeaned, limited to really low-paying jobs, treated still without last names, Aunt Sally, Uncle George, you know, anything they wanted to call you. And black parents pretty much tried to shield their children from this reality. So they didn't talk about their work very much. I mean, I've interviewed lots of black people in Chapel Hill. They said their parents didn't talk about their work very much, but they noticed. There was a good friend of mine who's Stella Farrar, who was one of the young black high school students who was very active in the movement. And she had a little crowd of women who were like the real risk takers and troublemakers during the sit-ins. And she had grown up, her mother was took in laundry for white people. That was one of the main jobs of black women in Chapel Hill, was they took in laundry for students and for white professors and stuff. And they had these big black kettles that they boiled over fires in the backyard. And, you know, it's a sort of a family affair. You know, everybody who was at home would work on that, and sometimes, you know, women from around the neighborhood would come together. And this was part of black culture, and it was a way that black people were able to not only be a little bit independent and make some money, but also have a social connection. And her mother did that, but she also did ironing and starching. And so these white employers would send her these huge amounts of laundry to do, and she would have to stay up late at night ironing this lace and this fine sort of fabric kinds of things, starching it. And Stella, who was a kid at the time, you know, growing up, would feel bad because her mother didn't have time to iron her clothes or do the things to be with her that she needed. And Stella wanted to be a fashion model. She saw a sign at the Coke store of this black woman who was a fashion model. Not a black woman, but a white woman. She decided she wanted to be a fashion model. And she ended up getting pregnant when she was a teenager, and ended up having to be not a fashion model, but a low-wage worker. She actually taught special ed here in the Chapel Hill school system. And she is a great person. Her brother is the head of the Chapel Hill Harbor NAACP now, Eugene Farrar. But that's the kind of bitter legacy of slavery and Jim Crow that folks here had to deal with. And that's why there was a movement. I'll never get this one. This just gives you a visual image of the kind of lives that white people led in Chapel Hill, that Professor Caldwell. And that's his servant, whatever her name was, Jane Sell. And, you know, this is a recent book about Chapel Hill. And it's so racist that, you know, Professor Caldwell had a favorite pose at home. How ugly is that? Young black woman waiting on him for life. Nothing. and supporting the white faculty at the university to be able to do their research and teaching and these were the conditions that led to the Chapel Hill Civil Rights Movement. We had a big movement here. And there was hundreds and hundreds of arrests, hundreds of marches, hundreds of sit-ins. This was in 1963. The first sit-in was in 1960, following the A&T Greensboro sit-in. But and who was it who led the Chapel Hill Civil Rights Movement? Most of these other movements were led by black college students. We didn't have more than about 10 or 15 black college students because we had no black college, and UNC was just barely integrated. So who led the movement here? Was it the teachers or the preachers or the business people or who were black? Who was it? It was the high school students. Your age, exactly your age. How many in here are 15? Anybody? James Britton, who was one of the organizers of the first sit-in, was 15. The oldest person in the first sit-in was 18. You people, you high school students can change the world and help. That is your legacy and your history. That's what a typical high school looked like. That's Mary Mason. She was the leader, the first president of the Chapel Hill Freedom Movement. A woman of great determination. She got into UNC and would have been one of the first black female here at UNC, but her family couldn't afford to send her, so she went to North Carolina Central. Her father worked as a houseboy at one of the fraternity houses, which is actually one of the better jobs that black people could get. Her two sons graduated from Carolina. This was a sit-in. You can see there's some white college students in there mixed in. This is what one of the civil rights movement marches looked like. Coming down Franklin Street, always. They came from the black churches, St. Joseph's Church up here on West Rosemary, right across from Greenbridge. They'd march down Franklin Street and end up at the post office. That's why we call it Peace and Justice Plaza now. So you had black high school students, you had a white college student, there's a white professor, the guy with the glasses. Definitely a mixed group, but led by black high school students. There was also a lot of very young black kids who were involved. Sometimes people came as families, you know, so that's their sister, I think, or one of their family friends, and these two little kids who still live in the Chapel Hill area. You know, quite moving to see the whole black community rally. Like Jim said, the older folks weren't in favor of it to begin with, but as soon as their kids started getting arrested and stuff, they got on out there. So you have definitely had older people marching and, you know, supporting the movement. This was the first big civil rights movement march in Chapel Hill in 1963, and Jim told you about the flying wedge from A&T. This right here is a guy who was part of the flying wedge. He was back in Chapel Hill just for the demonstration, but he went to A&T, and his name is Fred Battle. He was descended from the law professor Battle, who had slaves in Chapel Hill. He's got green eyes. And he is now, he has been the president of the Chapel Hill Harbor NAACP. He just retired from there. My close friend, Tim Hedrick, with him on Saturday. A lot of the folks who participated then still live in Chapel Hill. This is how the police piled up the demonstrators. They were nonviolent completely. They were trained. They had training sessions. And anybody who couldn't be nonviolent was not allowed to participate. And the police are sort of telling them that you all stay in place. And in the background there, you have a white mob that's being held back by the police. And those are probably a bunch of guys from Harbor, which was the real, you know, working class part of Chapel Hill. The movement here was pretty violent. This is James Fouché. The Fouché family had many brothers and sisters involved in the civil rights movement. They're still very prominent in Chapel Hill. Braxton was a Carborough alderman. James went on to work with Martin Luther King. And this is him being held by another demonstrator after one of the segregationist store owners locked the store after they started a sit-in and poured ammonia down his throat and into his eyes. And ammonia is a cleaning compound that burns and chokes you with its smell. And they were, like I said, nonviolent. They sat there and they took it. You had to be very brave to do that. And the solidarity of the movement was just incredible, with people supporting each other. This is a Big John Caldwell on the left. That's what they called him, Big John. He had a pharmacy that was in the black community on West Franklin Street. One of his sons, they're throwing James Britton, who was a 15-year-old who organized the first sit-in, throwing him out bodily. And Big John used a cattle prod on demonstrators, carried a gun. The FBI told him he needed it for protection because these were radicals from out of town, from San Francisco, who were causing all the trouble. The movement went on from segregated businesses to the Chamber of Commerce, which opposed the public accommodations law that would have made Chapel Hill the first community in the South to have open and free and equal public accommodation. So they set in at the Merchants Association to make the point that it was the business community that was really blocking things.
So they were unable to pass that law?
They were unable to pass the law, yes. There were three people who voted against it on the council and two who voted for it. The two who voted for it were the one black council member, Hubert Robinson, who had been the chauffeur for President Frank Porter Graham at the university, and Adelaide Walters. There's an older folks rest home named after her. And she was a liberal, you know, white woman on the council. And they voted for the public accommodations law, and the other folks were representatives of the business community, and they voted against it. People didn't give up after the public accommodations law was defeated. They kept trying to push for it, and they targeted the university and the entire community. This was February 1st, 1964. National Civil Rights Organization CORE had made Chapel Hill the focus of its organizing in the South. We had hundreds and hundreds of demonstrators, including allies from Durham and Greensboro and Virginia, and people from SNCC and CORE and all these different groups, all came to Chapel Hill and formed these human blockings of, this is traffic coming from the university parking lot after a Wake Forest basketball game. And that black guy whose head is just before the here, I don't know what the whole sign says, but that's Harold Foster, who was the leader of the movement in Chapel Hill. Finally, let me just say that the Civil Rights Movement won, even though we didn't win in Chapel Hill, it won nationally in the sense that the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, guaranteeing public accommodations, and the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. And so legal segregation, which was sort of the back of Jim Crow, got broken. And it was by hundreds and hundreds of these black young people, the adult members of the community, the little kids, and their white allies, of whom there were quite a few in Chapel Hill, who did this. And yet, that did not end Jim Crow. It only ended legalized segregation. The things that persisted were camouflaged. They were called equal employment opportunity. You know, how equal can it be when you advertise a job, let's say for a secretary or an electrician, and black people in the community have never had the opportunity to train to be a secretary or an electrician because those were white-only jobs. Most of the black folks had not gone to college. If they did, they didn't come back to Chapel Hill to get a job because there were no good jobs in Chapel Hill for black people. They would go someplace else. Chapel Hill was a town that the university ran, and it wanted its low-wage black workforce, and it kept it that way. And that's been the ongoing legacy of Jim Crow. It's in the employment patterns at the university, where there's been an ongoing struggle by the low-wage workers, who are now Latino and Asian as well as black. But there's still people of color. It's an ongoing struggle in the public schools, where we have this tremendous so-called achievement gap. I would call it a quality education gap instead. It goes on in all the different areas of life in Chapel Hill. I mean, the black community is getting gentrified out of existence by big things like Greenbridge coming in. The Chapel Hill public schools have not done a good job with this. And, you know, there's been constant pressure that I've been involved in since the early 1980s, and there's still very, very little results. But this is just one example of how the struggle has continued. And in the 1990s, the housekeepers at UNC organized themselves into the housekeepers movement. And they launched a lawsuit against the university. It was based on the idea of reparations for the long tradition of Jim Crow treatment. I was the historian who was the expert witness for the housekeepers, and they won an out-of-court settlement. The university settled out of court, so it wouldn't have been big public statewide news, their whole history of nasty, you know, Jim Crow segregation. And the settlement was for about $1 million worth of wages and benefits and renaming of a building for black workers and a health study and a variety of things. And this was part of the Martin Luther King Day march that we had in Chapel Hill. So that's a little bit about the Chapel Hill Civil Rights Movement and its connection to the ongoing struggle today. Thank you. I know we don't have much time, but
we've got a few minutes if anybody's got a question.
Don't forget your surprise for the best of us.
How can the young kids get involved now?
What's that question?
How can high school kids now, if they want to get involved?
Well, that's a very good question. High school kids can work with the NAACP. Could join my history committee if you wanted to. We do organize them. We don't just sit around and talk about history. I think that you have some kinds of human rights activities here at this school, don't you? I don't know if that's something that actually does any organizing work or not, but there are quite a few young people who've gotten involved recently in spoken word poetry, and there's a group called Sacrificial Poets that's led by a guy named C.J. Soup, who graduated just, you know, not too many years ago from Chapel Hill High. One of the things, there's also a group called Hidden Voices, which has reenacted some of this history. I think there's actually not some really, really good organized things for high school students to do, which I think is one of the big weaknesses of our present movement. But one of the things that the NAACP in particular is trying to promote is demanding that the public schools do a better job of teaching the history of black people in Chapel Hill, fessing up to the history of slavery and Jim Crow and ongoing institutional racism, acknowledging the way that the tremendous, you know, powerful movement of black high school students in Chapel Hill made things better for all of us. These things are not really honored and taught about very much. Part of it is that people don't know about it. But, you know, if there were ways to organize inside the school to try to get that as part of the curriculum, or to get some public commemoration of, there's quite a bit of a movement now for public commemoration. They've named some schools after black teachers and so forth, but they don't ever hardly tell you anything about the black teachers, so it's just like almost meaningless history.
Do you think that Chapel Hill has done, I guess, a good job of saying, you know, we messed up? Like, do you think that this area has really kind of apologized enough for
it? No. They pretend they have. They try to project a very, you know, equality, inclusive kind of image. But when you really look at it, there is hardly any direct public acknowledgement of the history of oppression and exploitation of black people in Chapel Hill. There's all this mumbo jumbo about why is there an achievement gap, and they don't really talk about the part that the public schools played in creating the achievement gap in the beginning. They don't want to touch why there's still an achievement gap unless they want to blame it on inadequate black parents or poverty or something. I think, you know, we've been trying to get the university to acknowledge its role in slavery and white supremacy and to honor, for instance, the cafeteria workers who went on strike back in 1969 because they were still treated. You know, we want a plaque up on the Lenore Hall that acknowledges their struggle, because even though they did put up this thing at the university called the Unsung Founders Memorial, which is supposed to honor the black workers at the university, it's really like this sort of slap in the face. And, you know, it's a little tiny thing, you're supposed to sit on it. It's not really a monument. It's more of a, like a picnic table. And it's right next to Silent Sam, which is the huge, gigantic Confederate statue, you know, honoring the Confederacy. And you can hardly even see this thing. And you definitely can't understand what it's all about unless you walk right up to it and read it. And so public commemoration right in your face, and especially for young people who haven't lived through all this stuff, there needs to be something. I mean, here's the classic story for the Chapel Hill schools. And this is the kind of thing you could do something about. When the schools were desegregated in North Carolina, Tim can tell you there's a book about this by Davis Selsky. Almost all the black schools were done away with. And the white schools were, you know, became the public schools, right? And when that happened in Chapel Hill, Lincoln High School was done away with and made into the administrative building. And a lot of the black principals and teachers lost their jobs. And the white students were all scattered and dispersed in all the black students were all scattered and dispersed in all the white schools. And at Chapel Hill High School, maybe it was the other group, Lincoln High School had all kinds of state championship trophies for football and basketball, marching band, all this kind of stuff. The white administrators at the new high school took those trophies and threw them in the trash. And a few of them were retrieved by a black worker at the school and distributed among the black former coaches. And there's been some little minimal efforts to make amends for that. But there needs to be some honoring and commemoration of the black schools. It's right around the 100th anniversary of the public schools in Chapel Hill, or the white schools anyways. And there's supposed to be a history coming out about it. But we need to have this stuff in the curriculum. People need to know how bad it was. People need to know how young people and people in the community stood up and fought for freedom, and that's why we have better than what we used to have. We don't have to be the way we are. We can be better than we think we are. And part of it would be to have some honoring. Some, you know, you could get a group together and say,
we need to get ready to transition from the morning to the afternoon. I want to take a moment to thank all the teachers that have been leading groups around this morning. But most especially, I want to thank all of our presenters today for spending the morning with us and making this a very, very, very effective and successful session across the board. I want to thank all of you for your time and your energy and your focus this morning. I want to remind all students that, like every Spring Fest in the past, the campus is closed. That means there's no off-campus today. When the bell rings, lunch will start. Vendors start in approximately 30 minutes. Again, thanks to student government. And thank you, Ms. Go.
Do you feel that today's youth seems to be very complacent? Very complacent, and they don't realize because they're not being affected directly with the oppression that they don't need to make any changes or any movements?
Well, you know, yes and no. I think there's been a huge emphasis on me first and career building. At the university, the black students aren't very much interested in protest anymore. They're interested in careers. But this is something that has been nurtured by the university, the whole idea of service as opposed to, you know, helping people as opposed to, pretty much opposed to righting the wrongs and fighting for justice. There's a big difference, you know. This stuff was righting the wrongs and protesting and so forth. And some people say those days are over. But I say, those days are over, but, you know, we still need to do that sort of thing. And I think that you can find students whose interest in changing things and their complacency can be overcome if there's some leadership, if there is some... I mean, I really didn't have a very good answer for that young guy who asked, or you asked too, what could students do today? You know, I didn't have a real good answer for that. If I could have said that we have a youth organization as part of the NAACP, or each of the schools has a club, you know,
It's just our experience as teachers in the system. For, you know, this is my nightmare, as you're with you. But it just seems like
you're smarter.
Two of the few ethnic
Yeah.
The what? We're two of the two ethnic teachers in the school. It just seems
you
like.
You are the only two?
No. Well, I'm
the only one.
I'm one.
She's the one Latino.
One of two Latino teachers here at the school. It just seems harder and harder to get the kids motivated in just their education, let alone realizing that there's a world outside of them. They're just very self-centered. And like to hear you say that the high school kids led this is just, you know, it's amazing to see that. I wonder sometimes if technology, with all the games now, the texting, it's kind of funneled the kids into this.
You know, I didn't tell you the story about these couple of kids who wanted to work. You know, the sit-ins happened in Greensboro February 1st. We didn't have any black college this year, so there was no big eruption in Chapel Hill right away. But there was this little group of black students at Lincoln who thought, well, it's up to us. We're going to have to do something. And so they went around trying to organize their classmates to do something, and they couldn't. They tried, and they tried, and they tried, and they couldn't get the other kids to participate. And it was fear. You could call that complacency, but complacency is always...
I think it's more fear.
You know, you'll ruin your career if you do this. That's what they tell the black students at UNC. You know, and what it took was a small, dedicated group to take the first step and take the risk and publicize the fact that something was being done. You know, they had to stand up and sort of wave the flag, right? And then other people joined in. Now today, it wouldn't, I doubt seriously, it would be as massive a kind of enthusiasm as it was among those black students. But somehow or another, somebody's got to stand up and say, we're going to try to do this. Well, we've got this organization. Here's the issue. I mean, you have to pick an issue and you have to make a demand. You know, so that we made a demand at the university that they abolish a women's award that was named after a white supremacist. Caused a huge, massive, statewide uproar. This woman was loved by all lovers, white lovers of the university. But we won. And most people didn't think we would win. I thought we would win. And it just opened up a whole can of worms. And the university has now been forced to pay more attention to its history. What would be an issue here that you might do? I mean, I know you're teachers. That means you're under the gun. You know, you don't necessarily have that widespread support. I don't know what kind of other...
Well, our main goal is closing the gap. The pressure really comes down on us. Mm-hmm. But as far as support, it seems like there really is no real support. Because it's so much more than just test scores.
It is.
But they're really trying to... The funny thing about education is they have that same mentality you're saying about not acknowledging what happened. It's the same concept. All students apparently come to us with this magic bubble. And they all have the same experiences and abilities. And they don't really acknowledge that... a lot of the things that cause that achievement gap are systemic.
Yes.
And not so much in the school system, but as far as a community, a country, a planet,
it's all
systemic.
Yeah.
But we're supposed to forget all of that and, you know, address it from a purely academic standpoint, which, I mean, it doesn't work. Because you haven't acknowledged the loss of connection for those students from feeling purposeful. For feeling a connection, why do I do this? I don't know. It was funny because I was actually watching a documentary about not so much slavery, but as loss of black identity last night, which is interesting. I came with this morning. But it talked a lot about how, it just talked about a lot about slave mentality and how that's something that the school system really doesn't acknowledge that it's ingrained. It is a behavior that was taught to a group of people that was programmed for 400 years. And so that programming then does not just disappear in the last 50 that you say that you have liberated people. Because as a group, a lot of us bought into that inferiority, you know. So it's not, when you talk about the students trying to organize things and trying to bring up issues, it's not so much that people are complacent, but they bought into the hype. I really am inferior to these people. They dominated us for 400 years, and so why should I do anything? And it's the same in our students. They bought into the hype that I am inferior. This is what I'm supposed to be. Media tells me that. Everybody tells me that. And so I don't really need to try because I am inferior. And there really needs to be a lot of, they need to really approach it from a behavioral cognition identity standpoint. Pushing curriculum down their throats is, this is not going to help.
Cognitive, I didn't understand the
Oh, cognition, meaning they don't, a lot of students today, like they don't know this history.
Right.
And so they have no, they know the way that they feel, and they understand the fact that they're inferior, but they don't understand how that message got there. And
right, because if you don't know the history, who can you blame it on but yourself or parents?
Exactly.
You know, I'm stupid.
Yeah.
I can't keep up. Whatever.
They don't, they know the shallow parts. Oh yeah, there was a civil rights movement and slavery was wrong and those types of things. But they don't understand the whole context of your entire cultural history was obliterated. Like all of the black philosophers, Imhotep, you know, Ella Baker, all those people who contributed things to how society functions, we don't talk about. You don't have a connection to those things of how you were removed from one place and stripped of your entire culture. And what that does to a person in terms of their identity, they don't have the cognition, the abilities to understand all that, and no one tells them any of that information. And so I like that you said it needs to be the curriculum because it does.
Is there any African American history in the curriculum?
I was just going to say that. That is really what this school is missing. It is missing a way to help ethnic students connect their stories and understand the context from which they operate.
Well,
I had that, the funniest thing, like the most diverse magnet school in North Carolina, I came from a predominantly black area and I didn't have any classes on that connection until I went to science and math and there was a teacher there that did African American studies.
Well,
until then, I didn't even know there
was. Who was that?
Oh, God, I forget his name.
Jamie?
Yeah, you know him?
Yeah, he's my teaching assistant.
Oh, okay. He ran the program there, and you do have to have that connection. Otherwise, you just don't understand where those messages come from, and so you feel like they're self-inflicted. It's the natural order.
I know maybe like 3 years ago, Chapel Hill High School, their history, you can choose your U.S. history, not U.S., world history, you can choose European, South American, African, and Asian. But I don't know if they're still doing that anymore, because that was about maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And I only knew that because at the time I was teaching middle school, and most of our kids went to Chapel Hill High School, and they had to choose which one of those four areas they wanted to specialize.
It's a little bit different situation for Latinos than it is for black students. The black experience in North Carolina or the United States is not the same as the Latino experience. And I do not understand the Latino experience very much. I understand the black experience a lot better.
Yeah, well, they have a whole movement, too, that is never talked about. I mean, a lot of students here probably don't know that I mean, a lot of the Latino movement was during the same time, but it was out west where the where they were concentrated. So there was a whole movement led by groups in Arizona and, you know, those areas. But again, they don't have access to that. I think the way to combat a lot of that, or the achievement gap as they call it, is really to see the to help students make the connection between that and why this these academics that really do seem so culturally biased are important.
Well, you know, if you just do a little bit of, I mean, this is my experience. If you just talk a little bit about local Black history, Black students get interested.
Yeah.
They might not even care about school. But, you know, you talk about the Fouchés and the Battles and the Alstons and the this, that, and the other folks that they know.
Yeah.
There was a Black guy who came in and did poetry. He may still do it in the public schools, I forget his name. But,
you know. Dreads?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know
each
other. Yeah, he still does it.
Yeah, so, you know, and you look at students.
Yeah, Shabazz. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was Shabazz.
Yeah, all
he's great.
You know, so those kinds of things in the curriculum. Yeah, Africa is good, but we need some more direct stuff, not just stuff that's far away or long ago.
Between,
yeah, what's the connection here? And, it all needs to be in the schools and acknowledged. And you probably all haven't seen it, but there's a great dissertation on the desegregation of the Chapel Hill schools. If I get your email, so I can send you the information. I can't remember. She's a white teacher who taught here during the desegregation period. And she basically what she did was she wrote a dissertation by interviewing Black people about the desegregation experience. And I did not understand this myself, even though I had studied a lot of this stuff. But when they desegregated the schools in 1967, the high schools, Black students came out of Lincoln High School. Now, they may have bought into Black inferiority in some ways, but on the other hand, they knew about Black history.
Mm-hmm.
They had teachers who cared about them and had very high expectations for them. They had role models. They had a PTA that was booming and active all the time. They had a state championship marching band, state championship teams.
They had a community.
They had a community. They had cultural events. They had a marching band, you know. All of these things were liquidated and done away with when they came into the white school system. They were included, but they were suppressed. And in a matter of months, many of these students who were getting good grades, feeling positive about school, so on and so forth, they started getting into all kinds of disciplinary trouble. They started getting depressed, and their parents noticed this. And people didn't really understand exactly what was going on, but there was this crushing of Black culture within the Chapel Hill integrated school, so-called integrated school system. And I'm convinced that that is the fundamental basis of the achievement gap. Yes, you've got poverty. Yes, you've got all the advantages that the white professional kids have. Those things have to be dealt with as well, but you don't have a nurturing environment for these students. You don't have a sense of their positive culture and identity. They don't know why they're in the fix that they're in. There's no community, or very little. It's being destroyed. You know, look around, it's getting gone. And so I think that somehow or another, we need to figure out a way to build a movement within the public schools that restores some of that cultural worth and importance and impresses on everybody in the school system the positive culture and struggle and contributions of Latinos, African Americans, Asians, women, everybody who was, you know, sort of on the margins of the American dream.
Yeah.
And then I think you'll have, particularly with the black students who face, I think, the legacy of slavery, which is very crippling, and people don't acknowledge that. Black people don't even want to talk about it, a lot of folks stuff.
What if there were an African American history course at this school?
And now, I don't want to say there isn't one, because I'm not, I don't think there is one. And if there is,
and if it furnishes people with a sense of community and strengthens their identity,
yeah, I think it definitely needs to go. I mean, larger than that. I think the kids even need that structure even outside of the classroom. But I think that is the way to start.
How many African American kids are here?
About 300.
Mm-hmm. That's a good little number.
Yeah,
out of what, 1,500?
Out of about a little larger than that. 1,700 now?
1,600. Yeah, my daughter and my son have both gone here. My son's still here.
Oh, okay.
I think he did it. Get outside to the at his band maybe playing at 12:30.
Oh, what's your son?
Oh, okay.
Sam Tyson. He's a sophomore.
I have a
but I was leading a church one time where I was doing a program and this African American woman asked, we were just chatting, and she said, "So where are your children at school?" And I said, "East Chapel Hill High." And she's kind of fuming. She was like, "How's that been?" And I said, "Great." The wall that went up between us was phenomenal. And she had a heart. We had been having such a good conversation, and she had enjoyed the program with me. But the very fact that I could like this school, and she and her kids had been, she thought they'd just been mangled here. And I think that sometimes experiences here are real different.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of that.
The school does real well with kind of high-end, upper-middle-class students who are off, you know, the Ivy Leagues and stuff.
And his parents can throw a great deal of pressure.
Yeah.
Politically.
But that there's not, that African-American students have a harder time here. But I've wondered if it would be possible to organize a course. If you had 30 of those 300 students, if you had 60 of them in such a curriculum, it might have a yeast-like effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it would be trouble trying to organize a course like that.
Well, I don't know. You know what I think? What happens is because if Chapel Hill still offers those courses, then what they'll do and they'll put in the registration book is that offered at Chapel Hill High School. So if any of our students show interest in that, first you have to get a teacher who would teach it. And if you don't, then what happens is that group of kids take a bus to Chapel Hill for the class, and then come back, and usually probably at the end of the day, so that you just finish off there and be done. And it still would keep that group of kids who are...
They're still isolated.
Yeah.
The only ones who know about it would be the original participants.
You also probably have trouble getting a class that emphasized having Black, Latino, and Asian students. I mean, usually, don't you, when you advertise stuff like this, probably the majority of the kids who show up are white. I'm not sure about that. And then, you know, I'm not really against that, white students being interested in that. But
programs that have, people have tried to initiate programs, but my thing is, a lot of times, all the stuff that they try to initiate, it's like, hip-hop based, or let's reach the youth where they are in terms of that culture, which is fine because few people actually understand the difference between actual hip-hop as it's culturally based, and then there's rap, which is mass media, which are completely two different things. But what they generally focus on is the rap, the mass media, that image, and then trying to reach kids from that point on and turn it into something positive, which you really, is difficult to do because those images aren't positive. And a lot of the things, I mean, even some of the teaching strategies they try to tell us, you know, are like, you know, have them write a rap about this or about that, but it needs to be so much deeper than that, of just this shallow engage them. It needs to come from so much more of just a historical identity context. And so, not to say that they don't do things here, but I think the things that have been done here really haven't worked very well because it turns into a party or a playtime because of that context on it.
A lack of respect for the subject matter, really.
Yeah. Because kids are getting together to like hang out, which is the way they normally do. That's the context they sort of put on it.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're doing equity readings, and the book that we've all been given to read, there's one chapter where they touted a teacher who did a puppet show and the puppets spoke in Ebonics. Yeah. But there's no history behind that, right? So if I were a black student and my white teacher starts doing a puppet show, I personally would be insulted. I was insulted reading it, thinking, well, what is this about? Are you degrading me? Or it, yeah. Yes.
Well,
you haven't read that chapter yet.
No. Would it be possible to, I think these kinds of things are what we need to pursue. But
yeah, in order to do something like that, though, it couldn't be done through us. You'd have to talk more to like a curriculum and instruction person in central office.
Yeah, well, they're hard to talk about that.
I know. I know.
We've talked to them.
Yeah.
But what about... there are some groups, I think maybe one recently formed for minority support groups of parents and...
Yeah, I'm part of the Latino support group.
And is that a good, is that working well?
We've done community events that we've gotten the community together, but I feel like it's so... I just feel like it's not really... integrating the Latino community with the rest of the community, which I think is part of the issue too.
Is there a black support group?
I don't think so.
Not to my knowledge.
There has been over the years, on and off over the years, there have been, you know, black teacher and student support groups.
We call it Abby.
And they got rid of the teacher who organized that. But I'm wondering also, would there be any possibility of doing some of the kind of stuff Tim was talking about out of school, after school, with students from different schools? Would it be possible to get anybody to come to a program after school? If you could have develop a little core of people who might then seed the schools with these ideas. You know, we had a group that came to the NAACP of black high school students from Chapel Hill High, I can't remember. And what they were about was trying to close the achievement gap. And the way they went about it was tutoring and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mentoring and things, which is fine, but I don't think it's going to get it. But with a core of people like that, I started by tutoring, back in high school, and that led me to more active kinds of things because I saw that it wasn't enough. You're not really fixing the problem; you're just sort of fixing the manifestation of the problem.
Well, it could be possible. We've done some events with the Latino community where we've had them after school and we've had a good show. So if you're saying like a history lesson,
I
think that could be possible.
Would that get students? I'm not sure. Maybe families.
I think the best way to start is to with students. I mean, asking them what types of things they feel like it is they need, what will pull them in.
You know someone named Lori Clark? She has a black student group.
Okay.
Somebody said he wanted to go see his son. Yeah.
Yeah.
What room are we in?
This is 214.
Oh, sorry, I'm 214.
The only way to do it is for
it's all right.
Has to be the change that we want.
Yeah.
And Tim is very vigorous and does a whole lot of teaching and stuff like that. I have a lot of health problems and I can't get out as much. But I have a lot of knowledge of the local black community and local history and all of that. And I would love to take your names and your emails, I can send you my thesis and my dissertation and maybe some other information. Maybe we can find some more people who are interested in talking about this and just have a little informal conversation to see if we can carry this further.
I'm definitely more interested in it long run because it's just hard to be part of something as a classroom teacher. But I'm currently working on my counseling degree. And I'm thinking long term in terms of what type of long impact things I would like to do in that capacity. And that's one of them. So, I definitely appreciate gathering some information about what types of things can be done and then maybe look into what could be coordinated later.
Let me get your names and emails.
So thank you.
Thank you.
I know students, we work with them every day, they don't show appreciation for things like that because they don't understand totally the importance of them. But
our first class was a real damn group, I thought.
Yeah. Well,
the second two classes, yeah, maybe that was it. The second class was pretty enthusiastic, and do y'all know that?
Aaron Krawlik. I actually taught him last year. He's a very good kid.
So, you know, you talk to someone like that, see where they're coming from on this.
Yeah.
Sometimes people won't say much, but
they get a message from you.
Yeah. Do y'all live in Chapel Hill?
No, we can't. We're teachers. We can't afford
living.
That brings up a whole other problem.
Yeah.
You get paid enough to afford a house.
No. Most of the ones who live here are at least 60 years old and married.
To someone who doesn't teach.
No, I live in Hillsboro.
Yeah,
Hillsboro?
I live in Durham. Yeah.
Durham. My daughter lives in Durham.
Okay. There you go. But, yeah.
Sure. Tim's part of all this.
All right. Well, thank you, fellas. I appreciate the information and enjoying this.
Thank you so
much. Thank you.
I really enjoyed sticking around.
Thanks for the work you do.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
And I think one of the other teachers told me, the teacher that uses this room is not here today. So whenever you guys are done, you can close the door.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Should we turn off the light, too, I guess?
Yes.
So what's happening with the band?
Sam's not playing right away. He's on his way here.
To this room?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We're going to go get his guitar and his amp out of the car.
This is a tough nut to crack.
Yeah.
He probably haven't seen that dissertation I was talking about. It's really got some powerful stuff in it. I mean, it's sort of critical educational theory kind of bullshit, but it's mostly the real powerful stuff in his interviews. And she doesn't try to write a nice storytelling, turn the page kind of thing.
Yeah.
She uses block quotes. That's what I tried to do.
You know, in a way, I love that because, it, you know, if one were, if I was writing about Chapel Hill, that would be like a gold mine.
Absolutely.
You know, I know what to do with it.
Yeah, and these quotes are not public documents.
Yeah.
She's an educator or sociologist or something, so, you know, they're all, some of them she doesn't name. The interviews aren't part of the library or anything. But, you know, it also allows people to speak for themselves, you know. And my professors always said, you know, break it up, you know, you're the writer. And I guess there's a lot of merit to that in some ways, but, you know, you look at my thesis, it's got more block quotes.
Well, I think it's different for a thesis or a dissertation. I think block quote, you know, lots of big block quotes make for difficult reading.
Yeah, that's what the teachers always said.
But,
I mean, your book never would have been a bestseller with a lot of big block quotes.
No. But the quotes are key. You know, I mean.
Right. It's amazing what you can get into when you tell the real stories that you know and that are close to your heart. I mean, I was almost crying when I started talking about Stella Farrar. It's such a sorrowful story and uplifting too. But Stella is now sort of crippled. She had a stroke. The baby that she had named Deirdre was actually Harold Foster's baby. And she was like a young black student, and he was like an older high school student. So this was like in the movement. But so, I actually did want to get together with you sometime. Is there any way we could make that happen?
Sure. I'm teaching my last class tonight, and then I'm taking this. I'm not scheduled up the way I've pretty much. I've got a little bit of stuff to do around graduation time, but. I've been saying no to everything, so I have some time to write. So I'm just going to be writing this summer.
What are you writing?
I'm writing a book on the Emmett Till murder case. Mm-hmm. It wasn't what I was working on, but I got.
Caught up in?
Well, my Carolyn Bryant, who's the white woman who worked at the counter that Emmett Till came in the store.
Mm-hmm.
She's now 75. She was 20. Yeah, she's 77 or 8 actually. And her daughter-in-law lives in Raleigh and gave her blood and signed my name for Christmas last year. And she decided, she's never talked to any historian, never talked to any journalist. She's been a silent icon all these years. And she wanted to talk to somebody and tell me the story of all the things that happened to her before she dies. And so she picked me. So they called me up. So I've interviewed her 3 times. And then the FBI, so to prepare for the interview, I start doing a little research, and I find there's one history of the Emmett Till case, and it stinks. It's got no research in it whatsoever.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I know. And you think this is one of the most well-known stories of the movement, you know, of the era. One of the most well-known American race stories is Emmett Till. You know, people know.
But there's been documentaries done on it.
There's a couple documentaries. There's some memoirs and stuff. It gets paragraphs and stuff. It's mostly mythic. In a lot of ways, a lot of this stuff is. But, so then I, when I met Ms. Bryant, the FBI had opened this cold case investigation on Emmett Till about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they were interested in seeing if there was anybody left to prosecute, including her, perhaps. If, you know, they didn't. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any reason to prosecute her, but they were checking to see if there was. And she was very forthcoming and helpful to them. And one of the things that's been missing since 1955 is the transcript of the trial. And the FBI found partial transcripts in three different places and put them together, and it's a full transcript. They retyped it.
Wow.
So they gave her a copy of that as kind of a thank you for being so cooperative.
Uh-huh.
And they also did an in-house, the FBI wrote a little, you know, book, a thick report on what they think happened in the Emmett Till case. And of course, it's a government report. It's not a, it's pretty, you know, but it's really
public document.
Yeah, except it's not, you know, it's not laid out at the library.
Right.
And so she gave me both of those things. So between that and that, it's all new material. It's never been in a book or documentary because it hasn't been available. And so anyway, one thing led to another, and I realized that most of the books are, they're books of whole books of newspaper articles about the Emmett Till trial, like a documentary history.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just like wonderful research work, but is not a book.
Right.
So I'm writing a book about this. I'm trying to do it pretty quickly because it should be quick. It's like everything I need for this book would fit in that box right there, that green box to help everything. Because there's this little stack of books, these documents, these interviews. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to really buzz saw through it this summer. See if I can, because I really want to get back. This needs to be done, and it's a very promising project, I think. But I want to get back to North Carolina too.
So, have you given any more thought to that idea about the book we talked about? No, the 42.
Yeah, I often think about that. You know, and you've got seeing your hearing you talk about the civil rights movement here, and seeing this stuff, it makes me excited.
Have you seen those pictures before?
Mm-hmm. Not. Where did they come from?
Most of them came out of a book called North Carolina and the Negro.
Oh, right. I've got that.
Yeah. And the thing is, the way the book is organized, they've got the photos all scattered throughout the book as if they're part of the different stories. But they're not. They're all from Chapel Hill.
Wow.
Almost all of them. Because you can look in the photo credits and see that Jimmy Wallace was the photographer. There's a few pictures by Al Ammon, but anything by Jimmy Wallace or Al Ammon is Chapel Hill.
Okay.
And you can also tell by the style of the photographs. They're really, really good pictures. Jimmy Wallace has thousands of negatives, and he's in the process of giving those to the photo archives at UNC.
Oh, good.
And I've been in touch with him, and he's told me I can use his stuff. If I had more energy, I would do a civil rights, a big sort of picture book with all those photographs and the story. And you know, a new kind of coffee table book.
Chapel Hill loves its coffee table books.
It does. You know, they probably sell.
I probably would.
But so I'm probably not going to be able to do that. But I am trying to get all these videos that I've done on my computer and find some ways to work with the library to preserve stuff, a lot of my papers.
It's very important.
I had a conversation with Jean Chapman day before yesterday. She's just been a tremendous help to me. You know, she comes once a week and spends a whole day working, doing things that I either can't do physically or I just can't get motivated to do. When you're feeling bad, it's very, very difficult psychologically. I'm feeling well. And we talk about all this stuff. She's got a very big interest. I mean, a lot of why she does stuff is for the kids. You know, it's not just for me at all. It's for the kids. And, you know, so the personal photographs, the family and all that kind of stuff. You know, we're trying to get all that stuff organized. But I have massive amounts of political stuff, videos and photographs, and a fair amount of papers, but nothing like really great organized papers or anything like that. But things that aren't available. And in terms of that kind of stuff, we're sort of mulling over what's the best way to deal with it. And, you know, I have potential surgery coming up in just a few months.
Yeah.
And, you know, I pretty much have to prepare as if that's the end. It probably isn't, but...
Dangerous surgery?
Yeah. It's a splenectomy, you know, and when the spleen is this big, it's 7 to 9%, they say, mortality, you know, within the first month, which isn't as bad as I thought it was. 30%. I used to think it was 50%. So this is a real study from the Mayo Clinic.
7 to 9 makes you feel like,
yeah, I could probably
roll those dice.
Yeah, I'll roll those dice. If it's really going to do me some good, which I'm not totally sure.
What if it works? What happens?
Well, it takes this huge spleen out of my guts, which messes up a lot. What we would hope for is possibility of raising my blood counts, because the big spleen destroys red blood cells. So maybe get a higher blood count, because right now I'm transfusion dependent. My blood count is very low, and you basically can't live with a really low. I mean, I can live with what I got, but I have to be transfused or I wouldn't live.
How often?
We've been doing it every 3 weeks. We're probably going to have to do it every 2 weeks, 2 units each time. And then the problem is you get a ferritin buildup, iron buildup, and you have to get rid of that or it'll kill your liver and stuff. And that's not always too easy to do. Sometimes it's got terrible side effects and you take the drugs for that. So we'll see. Probably go to every 2 weeks. And it might raise the hemoglobin, and it might also decrease this problem I've got, which is partly for the big spleen and the big liver, called portal hypertension, which causes a whole lot of fluid retention. So that's why my belly is so big. It's not just the big spleen and stuff. I've got 4 to 5 liters of fluid in my belly. That's at least 10 pounds. You know, I get it drained out every so often. I gotta go now, soon. It might relieve that some, and portal hypertension is also life-threatening. It causes these things in my esophagus called varices, which is what I've had two bleeding episodes, which have been very dangerous, and it has other problems too. So it might help those things. There's supposedly a 50% chance it would help the hemoglobin, 30% chance it will help the other, but on the other hand, it's a very, even though the risk is not, of dying is not, maybe not above 10%, the risk of having all kinds of complications and possibly debilitating stuff in the year or 2 year afterward is higher than that. And it's really painful. And it's really makes you totally dependent, you know, not forever, but until you recover. You know, the whole idea of being moving with this huge wound in my stomach. I guess women do it all the time with cesareans and stuff. But they hold up pain better than I expect to, although I have lived with it for a long time. So anyways, I have to sort of rush things up. Yeah. And there's two people who would know what to do with my papers, and that's you and Carrie, I think. So let me ask you that.
Maybe we could constitute a committee.
Yeah, something like that. It's not a totally straightforward process of what to do. Now, I will have, when I die, I live off of my mother's trust, which I get maybe between, say, $20,000 and $30,000 a year, depends on how much it goes up or down. And when I die, half of that will go to each kid, Sandy and Joyce. And they're committed to, they'll use it to pay off debts and things like that. And they'll use it for their own income. Some of it they'll give to Naima, my stepdaughter. And some of it they'll use for this kind of stuff, like paying somebody to do some stuff with my papers or something like that. So there'll be a little bit of money for something like that. But
you think UNC is like the best place for them?
I got a good relationship with the UNC library, so the different things, you know, I've got interviews, I've got videos, I've got photographs.
What are the videos of?
Huh? The videos are of all of the political activities that I've been involved in on campus and in the community since the early 90s. So I have, 30 or 40 videos of things like the annual Martin Luther King Day marches, the speeches, the about the anti-Klan decoration of Saunders Hall. I've got the video of that. I bought the video camera to do that, actually. Nice video. And then I've got the teach-in that follows, and I've got the speak-out in the pit that follows, and I got the BSM presentation where all the people who were involved got up and spoke. You know, so I got a whole little package on the Saunders Hall thing. And part of what I was doing with meeting with you and some of those other faculty was, trying to institutionalize people teaching about this kind of stuff. And, that's the kind of project that you could direct somebody to write a paper about that. And there would be a lot of sources, So I got that for that, I've got that for housekeepers movement, I've got that for a little bit of that for like the 1980 housekeeper stuff that I was involved in. Photographs of that. I've got some of the November 3rd stuff. The 15th or 20th or 25th anniversary speeches and stuff like that. I've got Black Public Workers Association. I've got a bunch of stuff on the landfill and environmental racism. Probably 5 or 6 videos on that period of like 10 years or so. So I've got all that stuff, and
it's important stuff.
It is important stuff, and nobody else has it. And I mean, there are other sources, newspapers and stuff like that, and people who could be interviewed. But nothing like a good video.
Yeah, good man. I thought I had done absolutely, completely exhaustive research on Robert Williams to the point of obsession. I mean, you know, I was getting convinced that I'd looked at every scrap of paper with his name attached to it in the entire world. Although I knew there was probably stuff in China and Cuba and the government where we're not going to, you know, get soon. But then when we made the documentary film, you know, they needed film, and I didn't even think of film, and they found lots of film footage.
TV stations.
TV stations, Cuban TV, you know, and I thought...
Who's they?
Oh, the documentary filmmakers at the University of Florida, who, you know, they came to me and they wanted to do this film on Robert Williams, and I gave them all my research and was happy to cooperate.
Yeah.
Served as a consultant. But then they went looking for film, and there was a surprising amount of film.
See, there's a lot of that stuff around that I don't have, that I haven't had the energy to try to track down at some of the different TV stations. Who knows what?
You never know.
FBI has tons of photographs and film and stuff like that. I don't know if you can get it, but maybe nowadays you can.
Maybe. But, you know, the kind of rich description that I like to do, obviously film and photographs are a fantastic source. You know,
they tell you so much.
Yeah. You can just sit there.
I just like that one picture I have of that white personnel director pointing his finger and then the expressions of black women's faces and stuff. I mean, that just tells such a story, a variety of stories, actually. And, you know, that would be hard to catch in words.
Yeah, that's... But, you know, you can... even mundane stuff, you know, you this guy... there's a guy who did this stuff in the 30s called Cameraman Comes to Your Town.
Uh-huh.
And this was his job. What he would do is come to a little town. He dozens of little towns in North Carolina. He did this. Comes to a little town, goes around with a camera. He finds out who the leading families are, what the leading industries are, what do you do in this town? Mm-hmm. What do people have? Where do people work? And what are the local landmarks that people are fond of and think of when they think of their Statesville, you know, or whatever. And he would come and film for a week, and then on Saturday he would show the footage at the movie theater, and everybody would come and watch and they would sell lots of food and popcorn and stuff, and the Chamber of Commerce would pay him to do this kind of booster film, and the film that they would make out of it to show about their town is not very useful. But the raw footage, you know, he's just going by, and, you know, there's Jim Crow happening. I mean, he's taking pictures of everything.
Right.
And what they would cut down to show for a Chamber of Commerce film, you can just imagine. Well, the uncut stuff, they've got 30 different towns of it over at Duke. The guy saved his film.
Do they have Chapel Hill?
Yeah.
You know, there's a film about Black Chapel Hill from, I think, about 1947 that's in the Chapel Hill Public Library. Right.
Get Sam. He needs to keep going.
But that sounds like that would be. When did you say this was done?
In the 30s.
30s.
40s. Mostly 30s.
And where is it? The Center for Documentary Studies?
It's over at Perkins Library.
Perkins, yes.
Yeah, the center doesn't really have collections. They don't.
Uh-huh.
there's no point duplicating library conditions.
Oh, you know what? I've been recording our conversation. I forgot. I don't know if it actually recorded anything.
Probably did. These little electronic gadgets are amazing.